You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the September 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Hurricanes Irma and Maria devastated many of the islands in the Caribbean, but this time Haiti, hit the hardest by many of the hurricanes in the past, was largely spared, while the Dominican Republic, with which it shares the island of Hispaniola, was battered by high winds and rain. Haiti already had enough problems. It is still recovering from the devastating earthquake in January 2010 that took the lives of more than 200,000 people and destroyed the country's infrastructure, and Hurricane Matthew last year, in which another thousand perished. While many stateside volunteers, including some from Mendocino County, went to Haiti to help in reconstruction and provide needed medical and social services, more typical of the U.S. organizational response to the earthquake was that of the American Red Cross. It took in $488 million in tax-exempt donations and ended up building just six houses. NPR reported on that story 2 years ago, and it came up again after Hurricane Harvey when some questioned whether they should send donations to the Red Cross. It didn't help the relief organization's reputation when a representative could not tell NPR host what percentage of the contributions to the Red Cross were actually used to assist disaster victims. The Red Cross's fumbled efforts in Haiti in 2010 seemed to be in keeping with the real goal of the 26-member International Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, headed by Bill Clinton and Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive, that convened in June 2010. That committee was set up to oversee the $5.3 billion in U.S. dollars pledged internationally for the first 2 years of Haiti's reconstruction. Haitian groups criticized the commission at the time for lacking Haitian civil society representation and accountability mechanisms. Half the representation on the commission was given to foreigners who effectively bought their seats by pledging certain amounts of money. An international development consultant contacted by the commission was quoted as saying, "Look, you have to realize the commission was not intended to work as a structure or entity for Haiti or Haitians. It was simply designed as a vehicle for donors to funnel multinationals and NGOs, project contracts." That's just one aspect of Haiti's problems. Another is the epidemic of cholera that was brought to Haiti by Nepalese members of the UN peacekeeping forces that were sent there in 2004 following the second coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president. By the time the UN admitted culpability in 2010, over 10,000 Haitians were dead. This coming Saturday, September 30th, will be the 26th anniversary of the first coup against Aristide. And at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Pierre Laboissière, longtime Haitian activist and co-founder of the Berkeley-based Haiti Action Committee, about Aristide, the Lavalas movement that supported him, and the current wave of protest against another U.S. puppet government. So stay tuned for that. Sunday's elections in Germany saw the latest fallout from America's post-9/11 wars. The successful immersion into the heart of German politics of an extreme right-wing party calling itself the Alternative for Germany. Its origins are strikingly similar to parties that have sprung up across Europe since the U.S. invaded and dismantled Iraq, deposing Saddam Hussein, then overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, resulting in the dismemberment of Libya and opening the continent to a flow of refugees that hasn't stopped. That despite the impact those wars have had on Europe and Africa, the U.S. continues to support forces trying to take down Bashar al-Assad and break up Syria is a clear indication that the war makers in Washington have learned no lessons from their crimes, nor has the public or any world body held them to account. So I would argue the Alternative for Germany party, or AFD, is our baby. Its success is symptomatic of the continent's growing xenophobic racist response with Nazi overtones to the arrival at its borders of, one might say, the more fortunate among the millions of brown and black refugees and economic immigrants that Washington's wars have engendered. Thousands of them have perished in the waters off of Italy, more than 5,000 in 2016 alone. That's on us, too. Truly, we are the indispensable nation. What other power could have sparked what appears to be the resurgence of fascism in Europe? and there's little evidence, sadly, that any segment of the American public has even a clue or care about it. The AFD won 12.6% of the votes for Bundes, putting it behind the Social Democratic Party's 20.5%, which finished in second place, but ahead of the Free Democrats, who only garnered 10.7%, with the Greens at 9.6%. AFD's success was a big story coming out of the election, since Angela Merkel's winning a fourth term was largely expected, although not her low poll numbers. As Germany's leading newsweek, Der Spiegel, described it, quote, "The election result for the party is devastating, with only 33% of voters casting ballots for the CDU and its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union. This is the second worst election result in the conservative history." Even so, magazine writes, the young men and women celebrated as though Angela Merkel had just enjoyed a landslide victory. Upstairs on the sixth floor, where there were no cameras present or any need to play things down, a different atmosphere was palpable. By 5 p.m., Merkel and her fellow party members knew that the election result would be catastrophic. Up to that point, pollsters had been predicting the party would garner between 34 and 37% of the vote. That wouldn't have been thrilling, but it would have been a result the party could explain to voters. And then came the shock. 33% or possibly less. Nobody had predicted such a lousy showing. At first, no one said anything, Der Spiegel article continued. The state governors, government ministers, and members of the Conservative National Committee who had gathered all waited to see how the chancellor would react. "We are going to hold our line," Merkel said. She had already decided on the language that would be used that afternoon, as the CDU had achieved all strategic goals, that it had scored more votes than any other party, that it had the mandate to form a government. During a TV discussion with heads of the national parties broadcast live, just after the first results came out, Merkel said she was not disappointed with her party's showing. "Seldom has Merkel bent the truth so far," noted Der Spiegel. Since the Social Democrats had their worst showing in years, the party leadership said it would need to rebrand itself and would not rejoin Merkel's Christian Democrats as part of a governing coalition as it had in the past, putting pressure on the chancellor that she hadn't previously experienced. Der Spiegel's opinion writer Klaus Brinkhammer was pessimistic. "It seems clear that what will have to happen now," he wrote. "A coalition matching Merkel's Christian Democrats, its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, with the business-friendly Free Democrats and the Green Party, almost certainly under the leadership of a Merkel who suddenly seems shrunk and faint-hearted and whose days as her party's leader no longer seem infinite," end quote. There was one other aspect of the AFD success story that is causing concerns in Israel. The day after the election, one of its leaders questioned whether the country's national interests include Israel's existence. Alexander Golan, one of AFD's leaders, questioned Merkel's declared policy of a special bilateral relationship. "If Israel's existence is part of the German national interest," he said at a party press conference on Monday, using the German term Staatsräson, or as reasons of state, "then we would have to be prepared to send German soldiers to defend the Jewish state. If this is the case," he said, "then the issue is problematic and difficult as far as he's concerned. It's clear that Israel's existence is an important point for us, but to turn it into a national interest, it sounds so simple, but there is continuous war in Israel. The implications of national interest," he said, "is that we would need to be really prepared to sacrifice our lives for the state of Israel," end quote. That's from AFD's leader, one of his leaders, Golan. Israeli Prime Minister sent a message of congratulations to Merkel, which did not mention the AFD's success. If anyone was wondering, by the way, if the Russians had been involved in the election, a headline in the New York Times gave the answer, quote, "One surprise, the German elections is already clear. No Russian meddling," end quote. While Germans were going to the ballot boxes, Trump was waging a Twitter war against the predominantly black players of America's most popular and profitable sport, professional football, using such abusive language that the team's multimillionaire owners felt obliged to join their players in not only chastising the resident on Twitter, but refusing to stand for the national anthem, the playing of which has become a tradition at the start of most major American sports contests. If the movement to boycott the anthem keeps growing, and every indication is that it will, since there are 14 more weeks left in the National Football League season, who knows, but former San Francisco 49er quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who was the first to do so, may end up being his generation's Rosa Parks. even if no team hires him. By Tuesday, Trump was back with his war of words against North Korea and his leader's Kim Jong-un, although the tone of his rhetoric was only slightly lower than it was a week ago when he made his first speech to the United Nations. There he used the U.N. podium to warn Kim that, quote, "The United States has great strength and patience, but if forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea," end quote. This led the Washington Post Aaron Blake to write, "Trump's perhaps oddly chosen colloquialism masked what was a pretty astounding escalation of his rhetoric when it comes to North Korea. Just to be clear, the president of the United States threatened to wipe a country of 25 million people off the map," end quote. Aaron Blake from the Washington Post. Well, that was just fine with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been pressuring Trump to walk away from the Iran nuclear agreement. "And over 30 years of my experience with the UN, Netanyahu tweeted, "I have never heard a bolder or more courageous speech," end quote. What Netanyahu thought was a courageous speech apparently led North Korea's foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, to say on Monday that Trump had declared war on North Korea and that Pyongyang reserves the right to take countermeasures, including shooting down U.S. strategic bombers, even if they are not in the country's airspace. "The whole world should clearly remember that it was the U.S. who first declared war on our country," Ri told reporters in New York. He made his comments in front of the UN before leaving New York, where he had attended the meeting of the General Assembly. After reaching his car, he turned and came back to the press microphones to add, "In light of the declaration of war by Trump, all options will be on the operations table of the supreme leadership of DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. U.S. media outlets noted his words mirrored warnings from the Trump administration that all options were on the table in dealing with North Korea's nuclear and missile development and its perceived threats. At yesterday's press conference at the White House with Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy in the Rose Garden, Trump said the U.S. is, quote, "totally prepared for devastating military action against North Korea should that be necessary. That's called the military option. If we have to take it, we will," he said, adding that while it was not the preferred course, the U.S. was nonetheless totally prepared for it," end quote. His preferred course for the moment is to try to bring North Korea to its knees economically with ever-increasing sanctions, which past history shows is not likely to work.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Each year, the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University honors the late Hilda Silverman, a beloved activist for Palestinian rights, in a lecture series named in her honor. This morning on This Week in Palestine, we bring you this year's memorial lecture given by Martha Myers, an American-born woman who has spent her life working with a variety of organizations throughout the Middle East. She married a Palestinian man, lived in Gaza initially, raised four children, and before then working in development organizations throughout the Middle East. The lecture constitutes the entire program this morning. Here is Martha Myers delivering the 6th annual Hilda B. Silverman Lecture at Harvard University.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm going to have to beg the indulgence of all of you. I'm recovering from a cold, so I apologize in advance. Thanks again, Sarah. I don't think I've ever felt so accomplished. I don't recognize myself. I was lucky all those years ago to have been acquainted with Hilda Silverman, a woman brimming with a sense of practical energy and compassion. Having had this acquaintance, I feel a sense of wonderment and humility to be invited to give this lecture today. I've been asked to talk to you today about my experience as a woman living and working in the Middle East for the past 40 years. So this lecture is quite personal. I am sharing my personal views, experiences, and observations. In these four decades, I have lived in Palestine for the most, but also the Sultanate of Oman, Jordan, and Egypt. For more than 3 years, I have been living in Turkey in order to work on Syria, and therefore within the Syrian refugee community. I have worked in Lebanon and Yemen as well. I was married, bore and raised children, and was divorced in the region. I have been through a lot. The Arab Middle East, and I want to be clear, I am only talking about the Arab Middle East and not Turkey or Iran. The Arab Middle East is not a good place for a woman on the surface of things, right? We all know that. Let me review some of the realities. The Middle East is a region of dismal human development and gender equity profiles. Women in the Arab region are, on average, disadvantaged economically, politically, and socially compared to women in all other regions, including sub-Saharan Africa. Considering oil and the urbanization of the region, the literacy and educational attainment rates are comparatively low for Arab women. Women are extremely poorly represented in governance and decision-making positions in both the political and economic spheres. Family or personal status laws legislatively relegate women to a dependent status in marriage, divorce, child custody, and inheritance. In some countries, these restrictions go further, preventing a woman from traveling without the permission of a male guardian, or to travel with her children, or without the permission of her husband. Inheritance laws, based on Islamic law, stipulate inheritance for women, but at 50% of the male portion. This poses a relative disadvantage to women in terms of their access to capital. Everywhere in the world, labor roles are engendered. But in the Middle East, these divisions are particularly resilient. Valentine Mukaddam has aptly characterized this as a kind of patriarchal gender contract. Arab women are a small, tiny proportion of the workforce. The cumulative effect is gender-based discrimination and second-class citizenship for women, albeit in varying degrees across the countries of the region. The World Economic Forum Global Gender Gap Report for 2016 measures on an annual basis the equity gap between men and women in their respective countries in four domains: economy, education, health, and politics. It confirms the bleak picture for women in the Middle East region. Out of 144 countries globally, Lebanon is 135, Jordan 134, Egypt 132, Saudi Arabia 141, Syria 142, Tunisia 126, Yemen 144th out of 144, right at the bottom of the pile, Oman 133, Kuwait 128. In sum, we all know that Arab women are disempowered and that every day of their lives, a man makes decisions for them in terms of what they will wear, where they may go, if they may study, whom they shall marry, whether or not they may divorce, or choose to limit family size or control birth spacing. It's terrible, right? No place to raise a daughter. Thank heavens, the Arabs have people like me to come with gender mainstreaming and gendered programming, gender analysis, to fix things for them and to make them in my own image. Because, of course, my own image is great, right? Let's look at where I come from, the United States. The CDC National Violence Against Women Survey estimates that 5.3 million intimate partner violence victimizations occur among U.S. women ages 18 and older every year. This results in 2 million injuries, more than 500,000 of which require medical attention. IPV victims also lose a total of 8 million days of paid work, the equivalent of 32,000 full-time jobs, and nearly 5.6 million days of household productivity as a result of the violence. On average, 3 women in the United States are killed every day in intimate partner violence. A total of 1,500 women, on average, a year, are killed by a family member. 1 in 6 American women have been raped. Let's talk about pay. American women, according to the Institute for Women's Policy Research, are almost half of the workforce and are the sole or co-breadwinner in half of American families with children. Although we are better educated than our male counterparts, we still earn less than men, 80 cents on the dollar as an average. That means from mid-October to New Year's Eve, I am working for free compared to the guy next to me. It's even bleaker in the middle skill occupations, where jobs usually done by women bring home 66 cents on the dollar as compared to jobs usually encumbered by men. Compare these numbers to Lebanon, 61 cents on the dollar, or Tunisia, 65 cents on the dollar. Are we so very different? So what am I trying to say here? What I'm saying is that women's inequality, inequity between genders, and female relative disempowerment and disenfranchisement is a global reality and not just a feature of the Arab world. The Middle East, for a whole range of reasons that are beyond the purview of this talk, performs worst as compared to all other regions in terms of overall equity scores. And yes, of critical and related importance, women in all Middle Eastern countries are severely disadvantaged by unfair and unequal laws and policies. But to only understand what it is to be a woman in the Middle East through this lens is monochromatic, ignoring the complexity of culture, society, and human interaction in the region. I work in development and humanitarian assistance and emergency response. I can tell you that for decades now, assistance funding has come with solemn caveats about mainstreaming gender. The former head of UN Women and now president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, once said in a meeting I attended that in her view, gender mainstreaming meant doing nothing about gender. Donors insist on gender disaggregated statistics and that women must be quote-unquote represented. They promulgate serious policies on the topic, all to very uncertain impact ends. This well enough meaning Western agenda is ramping up and becoming more assertive. Of course, I do feel that funding and resources skillfully directed to members of the community like women who might not otherwise have access, is desirable. It's fair. And of course, I recognize that as men and women experience the world differently, the best assistance programming will be calibrated to mold to those different realities. I also support resources to support those in the Arab societies who are debating and advocating for more equity. But I have two concerns. First, we are not the only ones on the planet who wish to protect civilization as we know it. Western gender agendas are fundamentally grounded in a view that the way we live is the right way, and the way other people live needs to be fixed. The pushing of an agenda which many Arabs, men and women, see as inimical to their way of life can actually do damage to the question of fairness and to those who are working, for example, to address personal status issues like a woman's right to the custody of her children or to transmit her citizenship to her children. Very often, I fear, we do not get over the minimum bar of do no harm. Let's be honest. In the Arab world, the West is generally viewed with a well-earned skepticism. Indeed, we have colonized, expropriated, upheld repressive dictatorships, steadfastly backed the occupation of Palestine, invaded, bombed, and generally meddled. The apparent hypocrisy of our shock at ISIS beheadings and our acquiescence to Saudi beheadings, our concern about the status of women in the region when our very best friend, Saudi Arabia, denies women control over their lives in almost every single way, these things are lost on no one. So when we come calling, wishing to roll up our sleeves and delve into the intimacy of home, family, human relationships, and to improve things for women in the Middle East, we are certainly seen as something less than a skilled and honest broker. My second concern is related to a favorite quote of mine. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens advised that one should understand before disagreeing. Before pushing to remake Middle Eastern societies in our own image in regard to gender relations, or, in the marginally better case, advocating change, we need to understand the Arab world. And what do I think our pushing a Western feminist agenda misses? It misses that the Middle East is radically different than the West, and people view themselves and their world in a wholly different way. I believe it is important to remember that for the most part, social systems are set up to mitigate conflict and protect people. Before we start trying to tear apart social fabrics that we see as patriarchal and disempowering, we should look at things from a protection lens. Instead of analyzing, for example, a very common course of events in the Arab world, that a girl goes from her father's house to her husband's house, instead of analyzing it as if some kind of chain of custody transaction was taking place, and drawing the conclusion that she is merely chattel, let's consider what protection this system provides the individual in terms of her educational and economic opportunities. Let's consider what social and psychological support she is experiencing, encompassed by a family who will continue to love and afford protection as she starts her married life. Let's consider that for most people in the Arab world, The idea of living alone and separated from family is not a norm. It's an anathema. In fact, to me, the saddest women in the Arab world are precisely those in places where all the traditional social protections are being ripped away by global economy, war, occupation, and urban migration. And there is no substitute safety net. Now, of course, I am generalizing. The Arab world is not uniform. It is just the opposite. Different countries have different histories, experiences, and exposures. They have had different leaderships. Class differences matter. Religious diversity matters. Not just whether you were Christian, Muslim, or Druze, or one of the plethora of variables within those categories, but whether as a Sunni Muslim, for example, you are a Bedouin, urban dweller, or rural peasant. To which of the Islamic schools of law does your particular cohort adhere? How is your particular slice of life impacted by the forces that are driving what we call radicalization and Salafism? In my experience, a significant driver of the movement towards radicalization, as we in the West like to call it when referring to other countries, is the sense, reinforced by reality, that grave injustices have been visited upon one and one's community, and that the world is either indifferent or actually participatory. Injustice, real and perceived, can cause a retreat into some imagined moral order of the past. Does that sound familiar? We're calling it populism here just now. This may sound like a digression from the topic, but it is not. This sense that one's world, identity, security, and ability to navigate are under sustained pressure and attack is highly germane to women and their possibilities in the Middle East. All these differences are at play as one talks about the experience of a woman in the Arab world. And then, of course, individual personalities and socialized expectations come into play. In thinking about being a woman in the Arab world and the position of women, I prefer to steer away from the rather voyeuristic harem, veil, subjugation stereotypes and to point to what I think is a very important reality. The Arab world, generalizing, is a world constructed on the pillars of community. It is not a place, by and large, where people have the appreciation of individualism and the different drummer that characterizes our own society. Of course, a community construct, as opposed to an individual construct, profoundly informs how people see themselves. It influences how they evaluate themselves as being successful. It defines where they derive acceptance, approbation, and affirmation, things very important to the healthy human. I contend that, again generalizing, most people in the Middle East are most happy and comfortable in their skins when they are functioning within the normative structures of their community. Of course, there are rugged individualists, many of them. But most humans, at the end of the day, are hungry to fit. Let me ground this idea in the specific. I am the emphatic product of an individualist culture that has socialized me to believe that I can and should do what is best for me, and that my broad responsibility is that my exercise of my independence should not infringe or abrogate the rights of others. On this basis, I got up and went to the Middle East, something that nobody in my family or circle had even thought of doing. I married across religious, cultural, national, and linguistic lines. Nobody in my family or my world ever thought I should do anything other than responsibly exercise my individualism. I had a friend in Palestine many years ago, a lovely, well-educated young woman, a professional, much loved and nurtured and supported by her family. She, a Christian, fell in love with a Muslim, a very nice young man. Her family utterly opposed the match, as did his, because of the religious difference. It hurt both of them terribly, but upon consideration, both these sophisticated young people decided that the road to future happiness and contentment did not lie in bucking the system. It lay in working within their community. And frankly, they were right. The point here is that they made decisions about what felt right to them. And those decisions might appear at first blush to the American or Western eye as repression of free will. The conclusion they came to might not have been what would have felt right for me. But I have been raised to be happy in a social construct that many Arabs find lonely and isolating. And you know what? I sometimes find it lonely and isolating. In my life in the Middle East, I have lived through wars, coups, uprisings, suicide bombings, scary encounters with armies and armed groups, and the generally terrifying driving. Of course, when I have come home to visit, I've regularly been asked, "Aren't you afraid?" In fact, of course, there have been times when I have been afraid. But what people are referring to when they ask me that question is what I call the CNN effect. Media has exaggerated reality. Now, I need to say something here. It is important to me, extremely important to me, that I not be interpreted as diminishing the extreme violence and profound suffering in the region. Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Yemen. These are blights on the international conscience. But what I am pointing to is that even in extreme situations, the resilient way in which people go about their business is remarkable. And that the media's fairly exclusive focus on extreme violence does distort the view. And there is definitely a CNN effect when it comes to women and their roles in the Middle East. Let me address some of the issues that, in their presentation in the West, in the way they inform thinking on women's roles and positions in the Middle East, and in the way that they impact programming, do no service and actually great disservice to women in the Middle East. There are a lot of things on this menu, but for tonight's dinner, I would like to serve honor killing, Arab male chauvinism, women's complete disempowerment, women's role in the community, and clothing. On the matter of honor killing, allow me to say as a disclaimer, the phenomenon referred to as honor killing is real and it is terrible. It is, in fact, highly indicative of what I have been talking about in terms of the construct of Arab societies, where the group value has precedence over individual value, and where the community unit will act to protect itself from what it perceives as harm to that unit. The collective sense of family honor and reputation is a very powerful force, and there are historically strong survival reasons for that. UNFPA reports that there are 5,000 cases of honor killing worldwide, not just the Middle East, worldwide every year. But let's gain a little bit of perspective here. Remember, about 1,500 women are killed annually just in the United States in incidents of domestic violence. Obviously, domestic violence is not an Arab phenomenon or a Muslim one. It is a universal one. And yet, the U.S. administration's recent attempt at a Muslim ban specifically mandated reporting on honor killing by immigrants. As a woman, I find that pretty rich in light of the circumstances. A leadership who sees one sort of assault on women as boy talk and thereby provides a form of permission wants to double down on another kind of assault if it is perpetrated by Muslims. What is really important here, though, is that this focus on honor killing in the executive order is actually reflective of popular prejudices. Western reporting of honor killing sensationalizes it. Domestic violence should be seen as sensational, sensationally bad, sensationally unacceptable. And yes, it should go without saying that countries in the Arab world should get rid of legislation and practices which are permissive of domestic violence and introduce reform legislation and provide education and enforcement around that legislation. It should be made clear in the Arab world that intentionally killing a family member is simply murder. But the sensationalist, orientalist analysis of honor killing does absolutely nothing to further this goal. I have read articles in which Western observers tried to make the argument that honor killing is not a form of domestic violence, that it is in an especially awful category of its own. The obvious implication is that it's something extra weird committed by those terrible Arabs, and particularly Muslim Arabs. They argue that because the killer can be a brother, a father, a mother, or an uncle, as opposed to a husband, this crime is in a class by itself. Why? If the definition of domestic violence is the inflicting of physical injury by one family or household member on another, then it would seem that honor killing fits. Of course, the whole honor killing palaver feeds off and also nourishes a prejudicial view of the Arab male's chauvinist. Now, yes, generally, societal construct in the Middle East is patriarchal, patrilineal, and patrilocal. And yes, in general, there are societal expectations internalized by men and women alike that men are the head of the family and that authority, particularly in external affairs, vests with them. I am actually not so sure this is so different than the world that I grew up in and a world that I see still exists. But to tell you the truth, with some exceptions, of course, exceptions that I've seen in the Arab world and exceptions that I've seen in the United States, this also is a monochromatic view of the Arab man. The Arab man who is the insensate boss, ready to kill his daughter or sister at the slightest provocation, and indifferent to the dreams and aspirations of the women around him. I don't know this man. I haven't met him in 40 years, immersed in the region. I don't know anyone married to him, or who has him as a father, father-in-law, or brother. I haven't worked with him. I haven't seen him as a beneficiary of programs I've worked on. What I do see is Arabs as individuals, not stereotypes, each with their own needs and tastes, each as we all are, informed by experience and education. So, some men are more rigid than others, and some are more sensitive to the outward appearance of their dominance than others. And this is an important point, the matter of outward appearance. Again, people raised and molded by a community-based society do tend to care about outward appearance because these are indicators of acceptance and approbation. Of course, this concept isn't wholly alien to our own society, but the difference is perhaps a matter of degree. I argue that social appearances do not translate to men who are hard and insensitive. Actually, usually somewhat the contrary. Let me give you an example. A husband may be displeased to learn that when his wife's car broke down in the middle of the road, she simply had it towed and went with it to the garage being a province of men. In most cases, it's not the tabloid interpretation of, oh, men saw her. It wasn't that he thought she should stand on the road waiting for his orders. It is that he fears the potential perception that he is not taking care of her, resulting in her having to be inconvenienced. And in my experience, more often than not, he really does not want her to be inconvenienced. I am sure many of us would assert that this is paternalistic and somehow denies us equivalence. We might point to the clear engenderment of roles. Why should a man take care of me? Why isn't a woman as competent as a man to go to the garage? This is an individual matter, part of my point. But I wonder if there are many amongst us, male or female, who don't want someone who takes care of us and takes on chores and interfaces with things and places that are perhaps not our particular bailiwick. Which leads me to another stereotype, which is deeply prejudicial and does little or nothing to address the real barriers Arab women experience in accessing their rights. And that is the myth of the Arab or Muslim woman's disempowerment. This stereotype was very powerfully articulated by then-candidate Trump in his backhand reference to Gold Star mother, Mrs. Ghazala Khan. He said, "Look at his wife. She was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me." It is interesting how he seized upon the stereotype of the Muslim woman when in fact his own wife is a woman whose career has been the marketing of her looks and who is rarely heard from, focusing on her traditional role as homemaker and mother. If someone can tell me where the particularly feminist argument or message is here, please do. Again, yes, women in the Arab societies are legislatively disadvantaged. This should be remedied. I pointed to a number of the issues in my introduction. But in my experience in the Arab world, that is not the whole story. In part, because the story of the all-powerful Arab male is not the whole story. Like people everywhere, an Arab woman functions within and manages relationships and social constructs. They are interacting with individuals, not with stereotypes. My experience as a woman in the Arab world and with women in the Arab world is that in general, they do have loci of authority and power. Often the authority and power that comes with traditional roles. Indeed. But is that so different than anywhere else? At the same time, Arab women are also out there. They are educated, professional, entrepreneurial, creative, articulate, and unafraid. They are lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, and bosses. They can and do set agendas. Indeed, over the years, I have known Arab women married to very abusive men. They didn't shut up and accept this as their expectation. They fought back. Oftentimes, the fight back was through traditional means and safety nets. But the point is, they didn't see abuse as a God-given lot. By portraying Arab women in a stereotypical manner, as helpless slaves and concubines in some kind of imagined harem, we also fail to perceive their role in their communities. Women themselves are the most powerful enforcers of societal norms, for good or bad. But whether or not you agree with what the mothers, grandmothers, and aunties are pushing, virginity until marriage, marriage within your own community, the importance of childbearing, men's predominance, acquisitions of skills usually associated with women, you are missing a whole lot if you fail to understand that these women are powerful and do not hesitate to wield their influence. Beyond the personal and societal norm sphere, there is also the very important role that Arab women have played in civil society, community development, and the arts. They have been politically important too, not enough perhaps in the formal national leadership roles, but powerful. I have now spent a lifetime working around the Palestinian struggle, and more recently, the fight of the Syrians to throw off the awful Assad regime. Everywhere I turn, women have been and are involved, committed, taking risks, passionate. More often than not, they are not the frontline warriors. But show me the society where women in the trenches is the norm. Certainly not our own. If we insist on viewing Arab women and men in this very narrow, rigid manner of strong man, subjugated woman, end of story, then we don't understand the Arab world. And if you don't understand something, you are more likely to do harm than good as you interfere. Justice Stevens again. Understand before disagreeing. Women are definitely part of the equation in the Middle East. Which leads me to the final stereotype I would like to address, and the one that just annoys me beyond words. Women's clothing. And most particularly, the hijab. The discourse around the hijab bothers me in a lot of ways. Over the last 40 years in the Middle East, I have seen an enormous increase in the wearing of the hijab, and I hear the conservative narrative articulated by various elements in the Arab world, including women. I don't understand why it is that everywhere women seem to be the symbols of nation, culture, religion, politics, and this symbolism gets, in part, expressed by what they wear. But it does seem to be the case. That said, conservative Muslim dress codes, which require covering the body loosely and covering the head, attract an inordinate amount of media attention and commentary. Discussions about whether to ban this piece of clothing or another, and seem to be underpinned by a mass assumption that women aren't exercising will or choice in the matter of how they dress. Now, yes, of course, I know women who have been strongly urged, perhaps against their liking, to wear the hijab. And I have known women who leave the house wearing a hijab and whip it off the minute they get to a part of the town where nobody knows them. However, most women who wear the hijab, and that is a lot of them, do so because it is a standard piece of clothing. And they are comfortable that way. And if you have ever looked carefully at hijabs, you will see they have styles. And the way they are tied and folded can be intricate and beautiful. So the hijab is symbolic, but I am not sure it is symbolic of women's subjugation. And frankly, not a few Arabs, men and women, over the years have suggested to me that the sexualization of women's dress in the West symbolizes something and represents a form of subjugation and objectification. I can't say that I disagree. One thing I am very certain of is that there is no hard equal sign between wearing a hijab and the disempowerment or subjugation of women. It is for this reason that I find the debates about whether European countries should forbid the hijab in public to be stupid and beside the point. If the French legislated that I could only leave the house in a bikini or a halter top, it would have the effect that I would never leave the house. I would be uncomfortable in the extreme, and my personal decisions about my body would be taken away from me. There is a parallel to the hijab here. So, in trying to ban this piece of Muslim clothing or that one, where is the support for women's agency and empowerment? I love the Middle East. I love the history, the politics, the culture, the language, the food, and I love the people. My experience in the Arab world has been warm, and it has been respectful. It has been tolerant. And I think it's a great place to raise a daughter. In fact, one of the reasons I stayed so long was that I felt it was a wonderful place to raise children of both genders. So why do I see it as so great? Three reasons. First, basically, Arabs like children and welcome them and tolerate them in almost any venue. There is none of the sniffy judgment when you show up at the restaurant with children or the store or your friend's house. On the contrary, the warmth, generosity, and hospitality so characteristic of Arab societies emphatically extends to children, boys, and girls. The community-based society construct also means that everyone is in your business all the time. And this has a happy sidebar of the neighborhood watching out for the children of the neighborhood. As a professional woman and a mother, I have appreciated the liberal approach to children and the community support. Second, it has not been my experience, and I have not observed that it has been my daughter's experience, that we have been relegated to some back seat. My wonderful, feisty Gazan mother-in-law, their grandmother, doted on all the children. She was equally demanding of all of them that they perform in school. She encouraged all of them to learn and explore. Of course, her expectations of my daughters and my sons have been different. But that's fine. She relishes their successes. Of course, my girls' U.S. passports mean that they can transcend the personal status codes that can legislatively impinge Arab women, not to mention the rights abrogations of the Israeli occupation. Third, for boys and for girls, the Arab childhood is a slower childhood. There is no expectation of drugs, alcohol, or sex. The peer pressures in this regard are much, much lower. And that business of the neighbors keeping an eye on your kids, it doesn't stop. Maybe there are people who feel it is an abrogation of rights that Arab boys and girls are expected to forego sexual relations until marriage, which means for most until their 20s. I listened recently to an interview with Peggy Orenstein, the author of Girls and Sex. Her recent research found that 1 in 3 teenage American girls aged 15 to 17 report having given oral sex. Not received it, given it. Where is the equity in attitude here? Where's the equity in practice? And really, how many of you want your girl to think that her relationship with a boy is her providing oral sex? Personally, I fail to hear the rights or the empowerment in this. I hear inequity and disrespect. I have felt that raising daughters in an environment where they were not under pressure of this kind was a good thing. I want to say something about the title of my lecture today, No Place to Raise a Daughter. Of course, I hoped it would get people to come, either to wring their hands over the plight of powerless Arab women, or to flay me alive for my lack of understanding. But more important, many years ago, a colleague of mine very much wanted to accept a position in Jerusalem. He longed to work on Palestinian issues and to learn Arabic. His wife, my friend, a woman of sensitivity and intelligence, put down her foot. Absolutely not. As she said to me about their young daughter, I don't want my daughter brought up in a place that treats women like that. I have puzzled over this remark and her poorly informed view all these years. I understood why she thought the way she did. I applauded her willingness to champion the interests of her girl child, but for the life of me, I simply could not understand what she thought would happen to the child. And I have wished, as one does, that I had been faster on my feet that day over tea to say, wait a minute. So, today I would like to thank Dr. Sarah Roy, Professor Bill Granara, and the Center for Middle East Studies for having provided me the opportunity to say what I should have said all those years ago to my friend. Yes, the position of women is a problem and it needs work everywhere. But do not underestimate the strength, resilience, strategy, and determination of the women of the Arab world. The Middle East is a great place to raise a daughter.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
The rich man's bride lodges. I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you. My shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the damp foggy midnight.
You're listening to episode 523 of Unwelcome Guests, Ivan Illich and the Collapse of Power. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're varying the format slightly to focus on one particular person, the late, great Ivan Illich, though we will be looking in the second hour at one topic, that is his prediction of a collapse in the concept of social power. I'll be looking at how that might relate to a collapse in the confidence that centrally issued currency is worth anything. Last week, I went to look for books from Ivan Illich and was asked, reasonably enough,
which section shall we look for him in? But he's not an easy person to track down. In fact, his books were in about 4 different sections because he wrote on economics, medicine, schooling, Christian history, wide range, philosophy, and he tied his thoughts together in ways that defy understanding by a traditional specialist. So somebody who has researched one little area really doesn't have a good handle on the arguments that Illich is making. So he's a challenging thinker, but also a very rewarding thinker if you can actually get your head round what he's saying. There isn't much audio of Illich available, but he did write a series of books from the 1970s, and David Cayley did a series of audio interviews. And we'll be hearing a short section from one of those in the first hour. So we're going to start the show, I thought, giving a relatively clear overview of Ivan Illich's life. This is Robert Hutchinson in October 2009, speaking from the series Prophets for Our Time at the United Church in Winchester, UK.
For the last 12 years, I've been sleeping in a library. Sometimes there's only just that fraction of a second between the pleasure of reading and the joy of sleeping. And on one of the upper shelves in our library bedroom, there are 10 books by Ivan Illich, the 10 that are on this end of this row. They were all bought between 1972 and 1983, and until I started preparing this talk, for more than a quarter of a century, I hadn't looked at one of them. Indeed, when I took them down from their shelf a few weeks ago, there was a puff of dust clearly visible. And in the last 2 months, I've added the 2 books at the end to my collection, and both of those 2 are based on interviews that Illich did with the Canadian broadcaster and writer David Cayley, and I've drawn heavily on those, I'm pleased to confess. I just want to ask how many people in this audience have read a book by Ivan Illich at any time? And how many people have read a book by Ivan Illich, have read it actually in the last 10 years? Yeah, I think, shall we say, we're all in this together, as the man said last week. And I see this very much as a kind of discovery or rediscovery for many of us of Ivan Illich. Like Vincent Donovan and Leslie Newbegin, who were the subjects of the 2 previous talks in this series, Illich spent absolutely crucial and long periods of his life in developing countries. Donovan, you'll remember, worked in Tanzania, Newbegin in India for a very long period. Illich spent much of his life in Puerto Rico and Mexico. And what he said about the Catholic Church and about schools and hospitals was written out of his experience in those 2 countries. I first discovered Illich when I was working in Tanzania, and my parents, very good academic father I had, he sent me out, he obviously thought I should read it, a copy of The Listener for the 16th of December 1971. I still have it. And the first 5 pages of this were devoted to Ivan Illich, and there he is with his quite big smile and features there on the front page. And I think that was my first real introduction. And I noticed that one of the books down this end I did actually buy in Dar es Salaam. So Illich was born in Vienna in 1926. His family on his mother's side was Jewish, but they converted to Catholicism. His father was a sort of landowner in Dalmatia off the coast of Yugoslavia. And he once described himself as both a wandering Jew and a Christian pilgrim. I think his life can be divided into 3 main periods. There's the period up until about 1960, when he was really finding his feet among the Puerto Rican community. He first worked with the Puerto Rican community in New York, and then he moved to Puerto Rico as the, I think he was a deputy vice chancellor of the university there. And so that was the first period. And the second period was when he was at his most prolific as a writer in the 1970s, particularly the 1960s and 70s. And that was the period at which he was really developed his reputation as a radical thinker. And then the last period, the last 20 years or so of his life, about which I'll say a bit more later. Illich was a priest who thought that there were too many priests. And after being summoned by the Holy Office in Rome and failing to cooperate with an inquiry into what the authorities called his dangerous doctrinal views, his erroneous ideas about the church and his bizarre conceptions of the priesthood, he left the priesthood in 1969, but he never abandoned his vow of celibacy or his daily reading of the office. Illich, and I think this is what makes him particularly attractive to me, was a fully paid-up member of the Awkward Squad. He was forever questioning conventional wisdom. He spoke truth to power, I think quite courageously on many occasions. And he was always seeking to develop and elucidate his ideas. But he was also always a man of faith. He was prophetic, I think, in a number of ways. He recognized aspects of the human condition and indeed the effects of social and economic structures to which others were at the time blind. And he described crises and challenges, the full consequences of which have really only been fully realized decades ahead. I think we're realizing them now. It must also be said, though, that on the face of it, and like many prophets, Illich, in what he prophesied, was, I think, often wildly inaccurate. To take one example, in the 1960s, he wrote, "I expect that by the end of this century, what we now call school will be a historical relic, developed in the time of the railroad and the private automobile and discarded along with them." Well, here we are 40 years later, and schools are being built all over the world. There are new investments in railroads, and one of the most popular programs on television is about the pleasures of driving automobiles as fast as possible. So while this talk isn't a defense of Illich, what I do want to argue is that whatever our own core beliefs or faith, Illich's fearless questioning of established institutions, the constant challenging of conventional wisdom, and his recognition that our industrial society is deeply off course, all these are as relevant as ever, and in many ways even more pertinent than when he was writing. And I just want to highlight a few of his key ideas, first from the 1970s, 60s and 70s, and then from the interviews that he gave to David Cayley in the 1980s and 1990s. He died in 2002. I think the Illich of the 1990s can be seen as an evolution of much of his earlier work, the radical thinker of the 1970s. He didn't renounce his earlier work, but he was forever restless intellectually and spiritually. He was forever moving on in his ideas. So the five books, which are this end of this row, Celebration of Awareness, Deschooling Society, Tools for Conviviality, Energy and Equity, and Medical Nemesis, which is subtitled The Expropriation of Health. These five books, all published in the first half of the 1970s, were the books that made him a sort of global guru. And among the key ideas which recur in these books are firstly the questioning of progress, commonly held views of progress. Secondly, the argument that professions and institutions set up with the best of intentions tend to end up by becoming disabling rather than enabling, and that institutions and technologies tend to go through two watersheds, the first at which they become productive and a second at which they become counterproductive and turn from means into ends in themselves. He always preferred the old English word tools to the Latinate technology. Tools for him included hammers, but also included highways and healthcare systems, as well as technologies more narrowly defined. Illich's questioning of progress began as an analysis of the specific effects of schooling in Puerto Rico, and prompted his critique of the whole range of ideas, practices, and institutions implicated in the term development. He noticed how schools in Puerto Rico thwarted the very objective at which they ostensibly aim, equality of opportunity, by monopolizing education and pricing it out of the reach of the majority. And so in deschooling society, he identified schooling as the fundamental ritual of a consumer society. Schola, the Greek word from which ours derives, means leisure. And true learning, according to Illich, can only be true learning can only be the leisured pursuit of free people. The scope of the argument in deschooling society was broader than just the nature of schools. Illich didn't object to the existence of schools so long as they were recognized as privileged enclaves and didn't monopolize public choice. He wanted to help bring about a society founded on a vision of freedom from envy and from addictive dependence on institutions. And this was central to his broader critique of the model of development promoted by the American and other governments. Illich saw development as a war on subsistence that would replace a tolerable absence of goods and services by a much more painful condition, which he named modernized poverty. Development, Illich argued, opens a vista onto an earthly paradise of never-ending consumption, but ends by generating needs that cannot be met and demands for services that can never be delivered. And at the same time, the glamour that attaches to development dulls the dignity of subsistence and disables the pursuit of self-sufficiency. Illich was conscious that schools grade, and in his view, they also degrade large numbers of people. Schooling fosters the illusion that worthwhile learning depends on teaching. And he argued that there's no intrinsic reason why the education that schools are now failing to provide could not be acquired more successfully in the setting of the family, of work and communal activity, in new kinds of libraries and other centres that would provide the means of learning. And I think we are now beginning to see Illich's influence rather belatedly at work in some of the developments, particularly in secondary schooling, the development of personalised learning, with much greater emphasis on collaborative learning and on student leadership. But Illich's criticisms of the medical profession were even fiercer than what he had to say about schooling. Medical nemesis begins with the bald claim that the medical establishment has become a major threat to health. The book explores the various ways in which the dominance of the medical profession disables its patients by undoing their courage and their capacity to heal, to suffer, and to die. Clinical iatrogenesis, the harms and conditions originating with the doctor, are these days much discussed and indeed understood. And only a couple of weeks ago, I saw a half-page advertisement in a weekly magazine for a society called SIN, which stands for Sufferers of Iatrogenic Neglect. And it claims that 30,000 people die needlessly in UK hospitals and 40,000 are seriously injured. Now, obviously, there's been a huge amount of debate and continues to be over that that aspect of the health service in recent years. But what Illich was particularly concerned to draw attention to in the latter part of his life was social and particularly cultural iatrogenesis. The fact, as he saw it, that people obsessively pursue medically defined images of health and increasingly believe that it is themselves that they are seeing in the distorting mirror of medical monitoring and screening and risk assessment. He wrote in Medical Nemesis that medical civilization tries to abolish the need for an art of suffering and produces a progressive flattening out of personal virtuous performance. Modern medicine, Illich argued, saps the will of people to suffer their reality. So he warned against the dangers of the physician being put in charge of life from sperm to worm, as he put it. He argued that unrestrained medical treatment deprives suffering and death of their meaning and undermines the cultural traditions that once allowed people to face them with dignity. It is therefore relevant to say that although he, despite all this, was not actually a fundamentalist about medicine, When a malignant tumor appeared on the side of his face about 20 years before he died, he sought no orthodox medical treatment and controlled it as best he could through acupuncture and by smoking opium. Once, when he was traveling by plane, an oncologist was by chance seated next to him and began to palpate the tumor without Illich's permission. It was as if, Illich joked subsequently, that he'd come within the doctor's jurisdiction merely by appearing in public with an untreated condition. In the 1970s, Illich pointed out that effective health care depends on self-care. But by the end of his life, he'd radically revised even that view. By the 1990s, responsibility for health had become, for him, what he called a rain dance, a way of warding off evil that at the same time domesticates it. In both Energy and Equity and Tools for Conviviality, Illich anticipated the unprecedented, I think, environmental crisis in which we now find ourselves. It is part of the reality of the 21st century that reducing carbon emissions from transport is one of the toughest nuts to crack in trying to meet the challenge of climate change. But 35 years ago, long before there was any serious public discussion of global warming, Illich argued that high speed is the critical factor which makes transportation socially destructive. A true choice among political systems and of desirable social relations is only possible where speed is restrained. Participatory democracy demands low energy technology, and free people must travel the road to productive social relations at the speed of the bicycle. That's from Energy and Equity, in which he also pointed out that if you factor in all the time that Americans spend every year on earning the money to pay for their car and to maintain it, quote, the model American each year puts in 1,600 hours to get 7,500 miles, less than 5 miles per hour. The more people use cars, the less useful cars become. Up to a certain speed and density, automobiles may expand mobility, but beyond this threshold, society becomes their prisoner. And he goes on to say that just as the demand for better health at all costs is a form of mental sickness, so is the pretense of higher speed. And no doubt he had the contrast between the bicycle and the car partly in mind when he wrote in Tools for Conviviality, "Tools foster conviviality to the extent to which they can be easily used by anybody, as often or as seldom as desired, for the accomplishment of a purpose chosen by the user. The use of such tools by one person does not restrain another from using them equally. They do not require previous certification of the user. Their existence does not impose any obligation to use them. They allow the user to express his meaning in action." The idea that Illich urgently wanted to establish in his books of the 1970s was that many contemporary institutions had reached and were rapidly surpassing a threshold at which they would turn malignant and counterproductive. Beyond a certain size and intensity, he argued in Tools for Conviviality, institutions begin to generate as many problems as they promise to solve. Illich was a scholar. He was principally a historian. And he observed the roots of the way institutions lose the purpose for which they were set up in the institutionalization of charity in the 13th century church. Indeed, the church was, for Illich, the prototype of all subsequent service bureaucracies. Well, now, that's a rather kind of rapid tour of some of Illich's main ideas from the 1970s and 1960s, but it's worth noting that these countercultural ideas were first expressed by Illich in the 1960s, but greatly expanded on in the books and pamphlets in the 1970s. In 1983, he published a book called Gender, which is essentially a work of history, but it was also a powerful critique of feminism, in that he argued that the feminist pursuit of equality would produce new privileges for a minority of women and new disadvantages for the majority. You can imagine how that went down in feminist circles in North America and Europe. And I think to do justice to that book would need a talk on its own, and I'm certainly not qualified to do it. But most of the reviews were hostile. Illich was sharply attacked by feminists and others for being both a reactionary and a romantic. And it really marked the end of the period in which Illich was in great demand as a sort of charismatic lecturer and teacher. Illich's work in the 1960s and 1970s was a call to institutional revolution. As David Cayley put it, he outlined the marriage of playfulness, austerity, and the sense of scale that he felt would be necessary to counteract the prevailing technomania and institutional hubris. But Illich's hopes in the 60s and 70s were not realized, and we're still faced with the fact that we have the technology of the gods and the politics of children. And this brings me to a consideration of ideas to which Illich gave particular emphasis in the last period of his life, a period in which he was often in acute physical pain. His books were no longer published by mainstream publishers. He earned his living in the margins of a number of universities, but he did manage to persuade the U.S. Inland Revenue that a certain number of cases of ordinary but decent wine were his major teaching tool and could therefore be written off from taxes. I don't think that would have passed muster with Sir Thomas Legg somehow. From the start of his priesthood, Illich had distinguished two forms of the church, which he called the church as she and the church as it. To the first, the church as the repository of tradition and the living embodiment of Christian community, he was and always remained deeply committed. The church in this sense, he said, is that surprise in the net, the pearl, the mystery, the kingdom among us. But to the second, the church as a self-serving worldly power, he was always a pretty sharp thorn. Illich regarded the modern West as a perversion, indeed a betrayal, of Christian faith. He frequently cited the old Latin phrase, corruptio optimi qui est pessima. The corruption of the best is the worst. Or in other words, the depth to which we have fallen the depth to which we have fallen is the measure of the height to which we were called. For Illich, the church became less and less capable of discerning its own tendency to substitute power for faith, and more bent on a comprehensive regulation of Christian life. And what began in the church was gradually built into the unconscious foundations, the certainties, as Illich says, of the modern world. So he criticized the church for its inability to recognize the crucial difference between charity, always an individual vocation, a personal call, the charity of the Good Samaritan, and its institutional counterfeits. At the same time, he was a realist about institutionalization as such. He recognized that people are not angels and can't live without institutional routine. He regarded the institutionalization of charity, if not as an inevitable process, then at least as an entirely and understandably human one. In the book at the end of this row, created from interviews with David Cayley, The Rivers North of the Future, which was published posthumously in Canada in 2005, Illich elucidates on this central idea of his that the modern West is a betrayal of Christian faith. He also expands on his view that since the 1980s, society has been incorporated into a world of systems, that the computer had replaced the book as the root metaphor of the age, and that the moment of collective decision-making may have passed. This gives a new emphasis to what I take to be a mainstream Christian belief in our radical powerlessness. But no less importantly, he argues that for him, friendship has been the source, condition, and context for the possible coming about of commitment and like-mindedness. In effect, the search for truth depends on the cultivation of an open group of people who are moved by fidelity to each other as persons and dare to maintain fidelity, even if the other one becomes a heavy burden. So just to recap on these three of Illich's ideas that he developed partly through his life, but particularly towards the end of his life, and I hope I'm not caricaturing them. To summarize, the institutionalizing of charity has inadvertently resulted in a betrayal of Christian faith. Secondly, in the last 30 years, we've been through a terrifying change, the incorporation of our lives into a world of systems that cannot effectively be controlled. But that thirdly, friendship is a precondition for the search for truth, and the search for truth must continue even while recognizing our radical powerlessness. I want to end with a brief reflection on Ivan Illich and human-caused climate change. In the 1970s, Illich was acutely aware of environmental degradation and was one of the first effectively to point out that energy policy should not be separated from social justice. Energy and equity go together. In 1990, he'd become genuinely horrified at the contemporary world. In a lecture in Hanover in that year, he said, "I can imagine no complex of controls capable of saving us from the flood of poisons, radiations, goods and services which sicken humans and animals more than ever before. There's no way out of this world. I live in a manufactured reality ever further removed from creation. And I know today what that signifies, what horror threatens each of us. A few decades ago, I did not yet know it. At that time, it seemed possible that I could share responsibility for the remaking of this manufactured world. Today, I finally know what powerlessness is. Responsibility is now an illusion." Well, my own view, for what it's worth, is that I believe that Illich is too depressed and too negative at this point. I personally don't believe that responsibility is an illusion. And last night in Southwark Cathedral, I wasn't there, but I've read part of the text, Rowan Williams told his audience that people should use the climate change crisis as an opportunity to become human again, setting aside the addictive and self-destructive behavior that has damaged our souls. This is what the Archbishop of Canterbury said. "Many of the things which have moved us towards ecological disaster have been distortions of who and what we are, and their overall effect has been to isolate us from the reality we are part of. Our response to this crisis needs to be, in the most basic sense, a reality check." And Rowan Williams added, "We need to keep up pressure on national governments. There are questions only they can answer about the investment of national resources. But we need equally to keep up pressure on ourselves and to learn how to work better as civic agents." Climate change is an urgent issue, and Illich would have categorized it as an evil, not a problem. Quote him again, he says, "We can suffer such evil. We can be broken by it, but we cannot make sense of it, cannot direct it." However, as somebody who always tried to think and to live his Christian faith in the thick of modern ideas and institutions, I wonder how he would have responded to Rowan Williams' lecture and to the statement recently published by the Religious Society of Friends, the Quakers, who say that the crisis of global climate change represents a supreme test of humanity's collective wisdom and courage. I imagine that Illich would have warned us against succumbing to what he called rain dances, trying to ward off evil while at the same time trying to domesticate it. But he did leave us with some positive guidance. Having lived a life of relentless questioning and intellectual curiosity, and having stressed the importance of tools for conviviality, Illich suggested at the end of his life that the best way to live our lives was through courageous, disciplined, and critical renunciation accomplished in community. So I'm very pleased to have had this opportunity to rediscover Illich and rediscover him with you. Most of these books are actually still in print, and most, I'm glad to say, err on the side of brevity. In one of his interviews, he said, "I have no expectations from technology, but I believe in the beauty, in the creativity, in the surprising inventiveness of people, and I continue to hope in them." Thank you.
In the second hour, we're going to explore the idea of renunciation, whether the emerging tools on the internet will allow for a global community to engage in courageous, disciplined, and critical renunciation of the system of hierarchy, of which we've studied many aspects on this show. But we haven't yet heard the man himself, so we're going to turn to one of the few audio recordings available. This is David Cayley, who is interpreting and summarizing Ivan Illich's own conversation. Ivan Illich was a kind of etymological archaeologist, if you like. He used to dig up words and study their background, when they were first used, what associations, connotations they carried, and the idea seems to be that, not happy with historical record of words, he wanted to get deeper into why people said the things they did, what they were thinking about. This doesn't always make it easy to understand what he's getting at, and multiple listenings may help. This is taken from an hour-long recording on friendship and foolish renunciation in the age of systems. And we start with David Cayley describing that, but just to give you an idea of what he's speaking about for this, he's talking about man as being central in his own thinking, that people used tools to fashion the world around them. And these tools got gradually more complex, and at some point people realized perhaps we are tools ourselves, and they couldn't draw a dividing line between this is me in charge of the tool and this is the effects of the tool. So he says sometime in the 1980s people's mental models switched from being the subject of what was going on to being incorporated in the system. Now let's have David Cayley pick up on that thread.
So long as there is what Illich calls distality between the tool and its user, the tool can incorporate the user's intention, whatever it may be. Tools exist at our free disposal as means to whatever end we appoint for them. This is not true, he thinks, of systems. Systems incorporate us in the purposes for which they were designed. We act within the system's parameters. The significance of this change lies in the way it shifts our understanding of ourselves and the world. When the world is conceived as a vast, interconnected system, extending from the microscopic realm of the cell to the macroscopic systems of the biosphere, the ground is cut out from under us. A system has no ground, and no external standpoint from which we can observe or influence it. The computer offers a ready example of this shift. During little more than a generation, it has become the primary metaphor for self and world awareness. Just as the wheel once suggested the wheel of fate, and the book of nature, the computer now suggests a cybernetic world image, the world as network, the world as ecosystem, the world as genetic text. And this new image fundamentally changes the self-understanding of human beings. We no longer stand with one foot outside the world as tool users, readers of the book of nature, or persons with an eternal destiny. We've become part of the system. This change in worldview is often hailed as a return to an older, more organic conception of human beings, as a re-embedding of the body in nature. Illich vehemently disagrees. He sees the system's view as abstract and disembodying. For him, it moves away from the sensual body of old and into a purely theoretical realm that is inaccessible to our senses. This disembodiment, as Illich understands it, poses a deep threat to personal relationships, because for him it is only as suffering, embodied persons that we can turn and face one another. The example he has used as his touchstone throughout this series is the gospel story of the Samaritan. Jesus tells this story in response to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" It concerns a Samaritan, a foreigner, who is moved by the plight of a Jew who lies beaten up in a ditch beside the road, and who goes out of his way to take care of the wounded man. What is important about it, in our present context, is the emphasis Jesus places on what the Samaritan actually felt when he faced the injured Jew lying in his path.
The Gospel says in that story, he felt moved in his belly, in his entrails. The Greek word for this is splanchna, that part when you sacrifice an ox to a god, you put aside as impure, because there's too much in it, the non-noble parts of the sacrifice. Now, the Samaritan felt touched in his innards, which would be probably the most respectful way of saying it in English. He felt this sense of this ease in his belly when he looked at that Jew. That beaten up one provoked in him a bodily sense of this ease. This ease was a gift from the other. He understood that this guy was in a state of misery. I carefully avoided saying in need of something. Through the attribution to myself and to others of needs, what I can give is that need satisfaction. And that really doesn't have to be personal. That doesn't have to come from me. That most probably comes with more effectiveness, efficiency, and competence if we call in the right professional or let the right agency do it. We are therefore in a situation of in which the disembodiment of the I-thou relationship has led into a mathematization, an algorithmization, which supposedly is experienced. What I consider during the last couple of years the main service I still can render is to make people accept that we live in such a world. Face it. Not try to humanize the hospital or the school, but always ask, what can I, at this very moment, in the unique ticket nunc, now and here, in which I am, do to get out of this world of need satisfaction and feel free to hear, to sense, to intuit what the other one wants from me, would be able to imagine, expects with a sense of surprise from me at this moment.
The other, for Illich, is always unique, particular, unrepeatable. He is this Jew, in this ditch, on this road, not an instance of a social problem to be solved or a need to be satisfied. Need, risk, problem are all categories that tend to disembody the relationship between the Samaritan and the Jew. They imply a planned and administered response, not that gracious, free, undue, inward stirring which provokes the Samaritan to take his traditional enemy into his arms. During the modern era, Illich believes, Samaritan agencies of various kinds have been the typical response to perceived social needs. But today, Illich says that he senses a growing disillusionment with this type of social outreach, and as its corollary, a resurgence of that free, anarchic spirit in which the original Samaritan acted. One index of this disillusionment, he says, is the changing meaning of the word responsibility.
Responsibility as a moral obligation, as a feeling which should influence ethical judgments, appears, you can look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary and its supplements, and you have to look very much into the supplement, is something which appears at the beginning of our century. 20 years ago, even 10 years ago still, but let me say 20 years ago, among the people with whom I usually deal, it's of course a very peculiar type of people, it was impossible to question that their responsibility for those children whom they saw in the ads of the Children's Fund with hunger blown up bellies were their responsibility. They were scandalized when I talked to them about responsibility being the soft underbelly of fantasies of, about power. That the responsibility they felt was a way of justifying their sense that because they were from a rich country, we have some power to plan, to organize, to change the rest of the world. This responsibility, this ugly justification of blown-up power fantasies, is something about which, from experience I know this, during the last few years, I can make people laugh. Laugh about themselves that they fell into this trap. A new sense of impotence is around. The future, which seemed something appropriable in terms of planning, designing, policy making, the very idea of policy making and policy execution, is receding very fast. It finds still expression with U.S. bombing Milosevic or Gaddafi or Iraq into a recognition of human rights of its own citizens. It still nourishes the new book by Rostov about the need of maintaining American police power worldwide as a condition for the survival of democracy. But the people who speak to me, different from those who spoke to me of the way they spoke to me 20 years ago, do recognize that there is a fallacy, that the world in which, in front of which they stand, not the future world, but the present world, is built on assumptions for which we haven't found the appropriate names yet. I speak with people who are beginning to understand that the language about the organization of power, prevalent between 50 and 80, has no hold on reality anymore. And no matter if they are people who come from an attempted philosophy of power structure, let me say Michel Foucault, or if they come from the Rostov corner, when 25 years ago, to his face, with people, I argued that in spite of my great admiration, Foucault assumed the existence of something, namely power, along the lines along which, after 1840, the idea of energy was socially constructed for the physical world, and power being something metaphorically corresponding in the social domain, people considered me evil, David. The recognition that we cannot help but renounce power, not because of a Gandhian or Christian spirit of renunciation to violence, but because the power which we sought 10 or 20 years ago reveals its own void, its own illusory characteristics.
This new feeling of impotence, of a void where the power to change the world was once thought to be, is for Illich the characteristic experience of the New Age. The world now confronts us as something unmanageable, as a complex, chaotic system of which we can never form a comprehensive view because we are inscribed within it. Such a world, Illich believes, gives rise to strange compensatory fantasies and reassuring rain dances which hide our helplessness. We dream of a return to Earth, a rebirth of Mother Nature, of ethical capitalism and global citizenship. But these fantasies, he says, only distract us from our fundamental powerlessness. Illich suggests a different path, a return to what he calls conspiratio. The conspiratio was the kiss by which the early Christian communities mingled their spirits and sealed their communion with one another. It was practiced at a time when Christians still sought to imitate their Lord's absolute refusal of power, a time when the Church had not yet made itself into the prototype of the modern state. To Illich, it symbolizes the way of love without power, free, self-giving love that meets no need and expects no guarantee, the love that stirred in the Samaritan's belly when he saw that half-dead man lying by the road. This way, Illich says, has reopened, as the modern project of underwriting love with power has failed, and the modern institutions in which this project was embodied have ceased to inspire faith.
The credibility of the world constructed, of the idea of citizenship, of responsibility, of power, of equality, of need, claim, and entitlement. The credibility of these as ideals for which it is worthwhile to consecrate your life is declining, in my opinion, very fast. Most people see this as a serious danger, which it is, to the survival of a democratic order. I want to suggest the possibility of seeing it as the end of an epoch, just like the Roman Empire, as the time of Augustine, and as an entirely new access, credibility, ease of moving into the world of conspiratio, knowing that it can't be contractually assured, insured. A renunciation to insurance.
That was 10 years ago, and I'm convinced by Ivana Illich's analysis that the sense of powerlessness is growing. And in modern times, we can think about the so-called financial crisis. Now, I'm not suggesting that it actually was unplanned, but I'm suggesting that it taps into, in the same way that all the talk about global warming is often hyped, a sense of powerlessness of individual people. And I think Illich is right to look closely at the language here. I would highlight the equation in most people's minds between wealth and power as being essentially the same thing, which of course makes it a zero-sum game and invests the small cabal who control the world's national currency systems with an unlimited amount of power, which, if you think about it in one way, is a complete nonsense. But most people don't, and even in this financial crisis, that is not yet being called into question. But I think it soon will be. Now, if we think about... Now, hierarchy, of course, by design, is unequal. There is intended to be a small group, perhaps one person at the top issuing orders to a much larger number. That's the purpose. Now, in about 99% of functioning hierarchies in the modern world, certainly in the developed world, how does that actually work? There's a few exceptions. Okay, maybe the Pope didn't get to the top by money. Maybe other methods were applied. And maybe some hierarchies are real meritocratic phenomena. But I suggest that in an ever larger proportion, it comes down to money, which is reflecting the dominance of private capital, not only in corporations, but increasingly in government. And this can lead to a situation which we find where a large proportion of Americans disbelieve the official story from the government, their conspiracy theory about the 19 hijackers. And yet, even in a so-called democracy, this is just the way things are, and people don't feel that they are capable to challenge this. And even people who talk about impeachment haven't got that far. Why not? Partly, I suggest, because of the equation of wealth and power. So in people's minds they think, yes, there's a lot of us, but we are powerless to make change because only the super rich, only corporations. Now, of course, looked at in another way, this is a complete fiction, because what is a corporation? It's a group of people, but if they're not operating in this anarchic spirit in which they can go outside the rules laid down to them, well then yes, they are easily controlled. Have those in the developed world, especially in the US, been subjected to a generation-long campaign of indoctrination that wealth equals power, that, as we heard when we deconstructed the strict father model, that ownership of wealth equates to virtue, and it's only the virtuous, the lazy, the stupid, who are poor, and that this is the way things should be. Yeah, that exists, but I think it's a lot easier to look at someone else who's poor and starving and say, well, tough luck, you shouldn't be so lazy, shouldn't be so stupid. Or, if it affects you personally, and it's your own family who are going without food, who can't survive, I think one is inclined, especially if you have a past history of hard work, doing what's expected, following orders, not to blame oneself, but to say, look, there is something going on here. And I think this explains a lot of the stress, a lot of the anger in US society. Now, will that actually ever come to a head? I believe it will. And perhaps measures like the discussion about the foreclosure ban is a sign of certain powers trying to stave that off. But we return to the central point that at the moment, in order to coordinate large-scale activities, there is nothing as effective as using centralized currency, and people still want large-scale centralized activities. More and more people are interested in growing their own food, especially in decentralizing on a larger scale, but at the moment, money is the tool that they're using to coordinate. But not to get lost in detail, I'd like to have a closer look at the way the structure operates. Now, inside a corporation, people are regularly saying things like, well, I can't do that, when they're actually referring to company policy. So, using the word can, not to talk about personal ability or lack thereof, but to talk about organizational guidelines. Now, this is not a small point. We're going to have some thoughts from Marshall Rosenberg, who is an expert on NVC, nonviolent communication. He's making the fundamental point that people do not force other people to do things, that although sometimes we express it that way, the idea is, echoing Illich, actually just a fiction.
At his trial for war crimes in Jerusalem, Eichmann was asked, was it hard to send tens of thousands of people to their death? And Eichmann answered candidly, he said, to tell you the truth, it was easy. Our language made it easy. That interview shocked, that answer shocked his interviewer. And his interviewer said, what language? Eichmann said, in fact, my fellow Nazi officers and I, we had our own name for our language. We called it Amtssprache. Amt in German means office, and Sprache, language. I'd call that bureaucratic language. He was asked for some examples. Eichmann said, it's a language in which you deny responsibility for your actions. So if somebody asks you why you did it, you say, I had to. Then you don't feel so bad if you have to do it, you see. You're not responsible. But why did you have to, Jack? Superior's orders. Company policy. They made me do it. I couldn't do elsewise. Very dangerous language, Amtssprache. Very dangerous. We have giraffe schools. I use the word giraffe, you see, as a symbol for nonviolence. We'll see today that the language we're going to study is the language of the heart. And so I use giraffe language for that because giraffes have the largest heart of any land animal. So, giraffe requires always being conscious of choice, you see. We never do anything that we don't choose to do. But I was teaching giraffe to a group of parents and teachers in one community, and we have giraffe schools throughout the world. We have 5 in Israel, 4 in Palestine, some in Serbia, and so forth. And in giraffe schools, of course, we want to make sure that certainly that the teachers and parents never use Amtssprache, one of the most dangerous languages in the world. To teach a child, you have to do something. So I was saying this one time in St. Louis, Missouri, to a group of parents and teachers, and a mother got very upset. She said, "But there are some things you have to do, whether you like to do it or not. It's our job as parents to teach our children what they have to do. I mean, there's things I do every day that I hate to do, but there just are some things you have to do." Well, I said, "Could you give me an example?" She said, "Well, easy, there's so many, let me think. Okay, like when I leave here tonight, I have to go home and cook. I hate to cook. I hate it with a passion, but I've done it every day for 20 years. Even when I've been sick." Well, I said, "I'll be very happy today to show you another way of thinking, another language that I hope would open up happier possibilities for you." Well, I'm pleased to report she was a rapid giraffe student. She went home that very evening and announced to her family that she no longer wanted to cook. I got some feedback from her family. The feedback came 2 weeks later when I swung through that city again and was doing an evening workshop. And who shows up? Her two older sons. She had 4 sons. They came up at the beginning to introduce themselves. And I said, "Hey, I'm glad you guys came up here. I've been very curious what's going on in your family. Your mother's been calling me regularly, telling me about all the changes she made in her life since the training. And what happened that first night when she came home and announced that she no longer wanted to cook?" The oldest son said to me, "Marshall," I said to myself, "thank God." I said, "Help me understand that one." He said, "I said to myself, now maybe she won't complain at every meal." You see, natural giving, what I started the day off with that song, anything we do in life that isn't coming out of that energy, we pay for it and everybody else pays for it. Anything we do out of fear of punishment if we don't, everybody pays for it. Anything we do for a reward, everybody pays for it. Everything we do to make people like us, everybody pays for it. Everything we do out of guilt, shame, duty, obligation, everybody pays for it. That isn't what we were designed for. We were designed to enjoy giving, to give from the heart.
Now that was Marshall Rosenberg on nonviolent communication, very interesting area, which looks at dialogue. He's a negotiator and encourages people to express themselves in a way which makes their own needs clear, but doesn't attempt to direct other people into any course of action, doesn't attempt to manipulate them. What he's talking about, in the sense sort of as a blowback response, obviously applies on the world diplomatic scene. If you want to look at how the US military has been pushing people around, how it's sowing the seeds for future conflicts by the way that it treats people, we don't have far to look. Now, a comparison with the realm of medicine might be looking, for example, at SSRI inhibitors to treat depression. If you look at the brain as a chemical system which is out of whack, this is sort of mechanistic reductionist approach which says that we're going to tinker with it, we're going to add this chemical, that'll fix the broken machine, then if it alleviates the symptoms, you might think, well, yes, it's working, but it would detract from looking at why that imbalance is there. Is there a larger purpose behind it? And, of course, Illich wrote a lot about pain. He died of cancer, so he was in a lot of pain towards the end of his life, and he wrote about it. He didn't go to a hospital and get treatment. He smoked opium to deal with the pain. And he wrote in his essay, Brave New Biocracy, health care from womb to tomb, quote, to demand that our children feel well in the world which we leave them is an insult to their dignity. Then, to impose on them responsibility for their own health is to add baseness to the insult, unquote. Now, maybe I'm stretching this a little, but it seems to me that the nurturing parent metaphor of George Lakoff, the idea that health is relationships, is more what he's advocating, that if children are feeling depressed, there's probably a reason. We've looked, of course, at use of mental health drugs, particularly to control dissent, for example, amongst children, as a way of hiding what the actual effect of forced schooling is. Now, to draw back from particular details, whether it's schooling or medicine or crime or these social phenomena, Illich talked about counterproductivity, suggested that when these institutions get beyond a certain size, then they start to work against their original goals, so that hospitals don't make people healthier, they make them sicker. I'd like to bring in consideration about money, because, of course, when an organization is a few people who know each other well, not a lot of what goes on in it will be monetized, but when it gets to being a full-time career for large numbers of people, of course, money becomes a very important phenomenon. Now that, if we look at central banks, which have insinuated their way into the controlling hierarchy of pretty much every nation state on earth, the idea that a small group of people should be able to set monetary and fiscal policy for a nation seems to me to be a very sort of Victorian approach, that small number of enlightened people should be in the right position to pull the levers to manipulate the whole machine. So by design, by assumption from the outset, it's a hierarchy, it's not a dialogue. Now, if these people had the best will in the world, it's arguable whether that system could ever work. Why do summary statistics, as we've seen in, for example, Adam Curtis's film The Trap, why do the statistics of the treated patients come to dominate the welfare of the patients? In a hierarchy, statistics are all that the management can see. They don't have the eyes and the ears. They're not close to the people on the ground. And that's before we've even looked at issues such as moral hazard, the idea that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So even in principle, never mind the human element, how sensible is it to have a hierarchy which denies that most people have any important information? What would this mean in terms of money to have a decentralized system? People in a decentralized system would be free to do things for other people, not because of what their boss told them to do, but because they themselves thought this is a good thing to do. They wouldn't have power over other people, because nobody would be holding a budget. Nobody would say, look, you don't get paid if you don't do what I say. How would things get done? People, for their own purposes, would decide, yeah, that's something I want to do. I like the effects of that on my local neighborhood, on those people that I care about. This is what I want to do. How could accounting be done in those circumstances? Would we even need it? It's a complex issue, which I'm not going to go into at this stage. If you want to have a look on the web, I've published on this at altruists.org/AE. Have a look under altruistic economics. Now let's replay from Unwelcome Guests 424, a long interview with Chris Carlson on his book, Nowtopia.
Chris Carlson is a writer, publisher, editor, community organizer, and executive director of the Multimedia History Project, Shaping San Francisco. For the last 25 years, his activities have focused on the underlying themes of horizontal communications, organic communities, and public space. He was one of the founders, editors, and frequent contributors to the groundbreaking San Francisco magazine Processed World. He also helped launch the monthly bike-ins known as Critical Mass that have spread to five continents and over 300 cities. He has edited 4 books: Bad Attitude, The Process of World Anthology; Reclaiming San Francisco, History, Politics, Culture, co-edited with James Brook and Nancy J. Peters; Critical Mass, Bicycling's Defiant Celebration; and The Political Edge. He published his first novel after the deluge in 2004, A Story of Post-Economic San Francisco in the Year 2157. And he is here to talk about his new book, Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. Chris, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing Nowtopia?
Well, Nowtopia starts from some of those long list of things you just read off of what I've been doing all these years. And going back to the origins of Processed World, when we were in the financial district in the early 80s, a lot of us were essentially discards and rejects and graduates of liberal arts educations. And what do you basically learn to do in college? You learn how to handle information. And so those of us that needed to find work after we had finished our time in the schools were looking, you know, at what was available in the Bay Area, mostly in the downtown financial district. And we found ourselves handling information in banks and insurance companies and things like that. And it was a very empty experience. And we really weren't office workers or information handlers. We were philosophers or historians or dancers or photographers or gardeners or you name it, a whole bunch of different things. But that's where the money was, and that's how we got our bills paid. And so that starts this experience that really leads directly to Nowtopia, which is that of a bifurcated life, a life in which a great deal of what you do is to take care of paying your bills is a job that you think is essentially worthless, or maybe you find it not so bad. Most of us try very hard to move on from the worst jobs to the better jobs and not find them so terribly onerous, and that's perfectly fine. But if you stop and think about it, most of what we do for jobs are kind of a waste of time. Most of it shouldn't even be done at all. I mean, I think huge areas of the economy, as we call it, it's a strange fiction. It's just us going to work every day. The economy, you know, those activities are ought to stop tomorrow. We'd be better off with banking, insurance, real estate, advertising, military production, the production of bad commodities that break in 6 months or 3 weeks or however long it is. You think of even good jobs like teaching. Now they have all these teachers like essentially in assembly line factories churning kids out to pass tests and have very little to do with teaching them to think or to be fully human or engaged with the world. Although many teachers fight that and are doing a wonderful job of continuing to present a fully integrated education for the kids that are out there. So I salute the teachers. I just recognize that the system in which they're working is really constraining them. Similarly, in medicine, you know, you have doctors and nurses who are, you know, really committed to human well-being and health, and yet most of what they do is serve the needs of insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. So there's a way in which our economy, if you will, has developed so that what we end up doing doesn't serve us. And I argue in my book, Nowtopia, that it's at that point of sale when you're hired. You just lost control over the world. You're not any longer asked, should we do this? How should we do it? Who should we do it with? Why are we doing it? All the basic questions of work are left off the agenda in the United States. In a democratic society, quote unquote, you would think there would be a rather intense discussion about what we do and why we do it. And how do we use what we do to get to the good life? But instead, we're in this society that has fetishized growth and has fetishized economic numbers as though they're some kind of natural phenomenon and they're either healthy or sick, and our rest of our lives suffer or rise based on these numbers, which are actually totally out of kilter to our lived experience anyway. And so we're in this kind of strange world where we want meaning, we want to reconnect to our own talents, our own ability to have artisanal relationships to our creativity, et cetera. And you're not going to get that in those most jobs. Over the last 30 to 40 years, and then going back even to the early part of the 20th century, most jobs have been made really stupid. Anybody can learn them. You can learn a job in an hour, or maybe a day, maybe a week outside. But that's about it. And most jobs, it's repetitive. It's designed to be that way so that anybody can do them. We human beings are the replaceable parts in the system. And it's very systematically set up that way for a very long time. So when you get to the position where you're looking for work in society and you take a job that sounds like what you thought you were training yourself for, and you find out it's this horrible, empty experience. It's very boring and very repetitive and leads nowhere and finally seems kind of pointless to do it in the first place. You're going to find your meaning elsewhere. You're going to find your engagement elsewhere. And Nowtopia is a book about how interesting it is that there is a sort of radical political and work movements, if you will, precisely happening outside of wage labor. It's not about starting unions at your job and trying to get a little bit more money or a little bit better benefits. Of course, people do need to band together where they work and defend themselves from onerous conditions and low pay. But what we see, the sort of agency, the sort of excitement, the energy that people have in life is really where they take it outside of work when they are not in the working class precisely. And I have a very broad definition of working class. Basically, all of us get up every day and go out and work and reproduce this world. And most of us have nothing to say about what it is we do or why we do it. That's the working class. There's a separation of execution from responsibility. It's a very broad understanding of it, much different than the innumerable sociological stratifications that people want to draw. I'm upper, lower middle class. You know, I'm over here. I'm over there. And, you know, really in our society, middle class has come to denote everybody between the person pushing a shopping cart down the street and the fellow or gal riding in a Learjet, and everybody else is in the middle class. So it's a meaningless concept. And what that served was to divert our attention from what we do to what we own or what we can buy. And our sense of political agency has been changed from what we do all day, our work, to what we do when we're not at work shopping. And that's really, you're supposed to shop well to change the world. And this is a big part of the political movements of the last 20, 30 years. It's like, oh, if you just make really good decisions as a consumer, you're doing your part. And my argument is that's totally false. You can buy anything you want. It doesn't make any difference at all. Capitalism determines what you can have. And we need to determine what we're doing as human beings. We should decide what's worth doing and how to do it. And we should create the world we want to live in. We could live a great life. Human beings could live really well all across the planet in a state of generalized abundance with enough of everything for everybody, in a sense of, with a real strong sense of ecological sanity and biological coherence, if that was the point of life, if we set ourselves as human beings to that end. But we don't. We accept all these ridiculous categories and fetishistic notions like money, markets, the health of the economy, as though these were something real. They're not real at all. We make them real because we get up and agree to this con game every day. But we could just agree to a totally different game and actually produce the world we want to live in. Of course, you can't jump from one to the other overnight. But we could start talking about it, and that's what this book is really an effort to do.
So the examples in your book are people who are doing what they want, and they're doing so in a cooperative manner?
Yeah, basically people are producing communities as much as they're producing interesting technological alternatives. And, you know, some of them are might seem kind of mundane at first glance. So, for instance, vacant lot gardening is a big part of one big chapter in my book. Another one is what I call the outlaw bicycling subculture. There's also the the sustainable biofuels movement, which is, you know, the sort of the tinkerer's grail of seeking free fuel. Everybody wants that these days, especially. The enormous amount of free labor that's gone into the internet and into telecommunications in terms of open source and free software development and continues to this day. People have a great motivation to keep creating things that break out of the logic of the market. And that area is interesting to emphasize because of how much it changes our imagination, especially, you know, here we are in the heart of a major high-tech zone in Seattle area. And, you know, all of us have something free on our computers, usually quite a few things that are free, whether music or software or what have you. And we understand that there's no reason to constrain it. There's generalized abundance. You can make 8 million, zillion, gazillion copies of anything, and it doesn't affect anybody who created it in the first place. So there's no reason not to see the world through this notion of collaborative labor, derivative efforts that base themselves on the shoulders, standing on the shoulders of the people that came before us, and producing beautiful new things from all that cooperative effort. And then it produces a world of abundance. That's a great metaphor for what the whole of life should be like. And so that's one of the things I like about the software movement. I can talk much more in detail about that if you like. But the gardening movement's an interesting one because it represents something of a reclaiming of the commons. And people went, you know, you go back to World War II. I can back up even further, but I'll just start it there. You know, we had this big victory gardens movement in the United States instigated by the federal government because they wanted people to grow more food to help the war effort. And everybody, you know, for a great number of people, that was how they could contribute, was by growing food. And by the end of World War II, 45% of the fresh produce consumed by Americans was growing in urban gardens. So when we think about a kind of a systematic transition toward a more relocalized life in which we produce the things we need locally amongst ourselves, and practical things like food and energy and transportation and communications is really what I'm talking about here. The food model of think of cities as urban food forests. They could be. We could actually probably top that 45% number if there was a, you know, kind of like a let's go to the moon type mentality about let's grow food in cities. Now, where would we do that? In just in vacant lots? I mean, that's where the movement starts, is vacant, you know, People's Park in 1969 in Berkeley. One of the first things they do after they take this fence down for the university to put up around a lot is they plant a urban organic garden. And that influences people all across the country. And pretty soon you have people doing this in vacant lots all over the place. And it's not new knowledge. It's actually very often connecting to the elders in the community who had already had a great experience of learning about the local ecology, putting their hands in the soil, figuring out what would grow in the specific areas with the specific microclimates and soil conditions and water availability, et cetera. And that knowledge got transmitted across the generations in these gardens. And now you have, from the 70s onward, this proliferation of community gardens all over the major cities of the United States. And in the back in the East Coast especially, they were really the case where this working class that once existed had been broken down. This is an argument that I make when I present the book, and I didn't really lay it out yet here, but part of the frame of reference is this notion of class composition. So you have this working class that had existed that we all kind of remember. Oh, yeah, that's when people all worked in factories and went to this, lived in the same neighborhoods, and you had these kind of intact communities. Now we live this totally fragmented and atomized life in which everybody's moving all the time. Either moving from job to job or home to home, and there's not that sense of stability, and there's not that sense of knowing each other. And if you want to talk about sort of, you know, movements for serious political change in our culture, you really need to have stable communities that know each other and trust each other so they can envision it from below. It can't be something just imposed from on high. And so this breakdown in the working class left a bunch of things behind, which was destroyed communities and urban life in the back east. There was these giant riots in the late 60s, and they burned down parts of the cities. And then the landlords burned down other parts of the cities. And the city's administrations in New York and Detroit and Philadelphia and places like that abandoned whole areas out of this sort of spatial deconcentration and you know, racism and other obvious factors. And so the people left behind, oftentimes, you know, women-centered communities slowly but surely start to rebuild their sense of community life. And one of the ways they did that was by invading these empty lots that had been abandoned that were full of needles and broken glass and cement and rubble, and clearing them and realizing this is a great space for a garden, for a space for our kids to play, but we have to clear it out. So they would spend a lot of, you know, community would come together to do that. They would plant beautiful flowers and trees, and then they would start thinking they could grow food there, and people would meet there across generations and across ethnicities and across different musical tastes and all sorts of different things. And then you have these amazing thriving spaces. And they really proliferated. You had over 1,000 of them just in New York City. In San Francisco, we have about 120. You know, there's huge areas of Detroit now that are under the control of what's called the Detroit Agricultural Network, and they're actually farming with tractors because there's so much empty land there. And Philadelphia has another, you know, 900 gardens and so on. And you can just find this story in every city. And in these gardens, then, you have these new communities, and you have people actually thinking about food security and really producing things for their own needs. And something really beautiful starts to happen with that. And then, unfortunately, there's the underside of this story, which is private property, because finally these vacant lots are not common lands. They're actually owned by somebody usually. Either the city's repossessed them and are waiting for somebody to develop them into tax-producing revenue streams, or they're privately owned, and the private owners eventually come back and go, wow, thank you for starting this beautiful garden and bringing the neighborhood back from the brink. Now I can sell this, or I can turn it into a spot for, this is great. The neighborhood's gentrifying. My land's gone way up in value. Thank you so much. I'll take it back now. And if you haven't, taken the opportunity when it was worth nothing to really get ownership over it and actually end ownership over it, that is to say, put it into the public commons through either a land trust scenario or public ownership or something, well, you lose, and that's what happened to a number of gardens, although by no means all of them in New York City. A recent case in L.A. happened. A 300-acre garden down in L.A. across from a food bank was repossessed by the owner through some shenanigans with city council down there, and many families who were living off the food they were growing in this huge garden were dispossessed of it. So this happens again and again if we don't take seriously the underlying dynamic around the question of the commons, which is private property. Now, one of the things I like to emphasize is there's a huge amount of common land in every city that people don't really recognize it as such, because it's covered in asphalt and it serves one basic purpose, which is to house private automobiles and occasionally move them. And that's an absurd use of public space. Absolutely absurd. It's a really inefficient and poorly thought out use of urban infrastructure and urban space. So at least as a starting point, I think one of the next tasks is essentially to reassert some control over that common space and for other purposes than merely the shuttling around or parking forever of private automobiles, and instead think of that as the starting point for urban food forests and what could we grow if we started shrinking streets to half their size. Maybe not every street, but, you know, many of them could be shrunk a lot. And that new space opened up could be the place where people are growing food and planting fruit trees and free fruit in every city. I mean, I was in the city of Belém in the mouth of the Amazon once, and the whole city's full of these magnificent, gigantic mango trees, mangueras. And every day at 3 o'clock with the torrential equatorial rains, all these fresh mangoes fall into the streets. And of course, there's a lot of starving people there. And these little boys who are completely homeless would just run around and grab up all the mangoes and they'd have something to eat. And I think as we go forward in our society with all the obvious crises ahead of us, with water, fresh water issues, with arable soil issues, with crashing availability of energy, et cetera. And I'm not a catastrophist. I don't think all this stuff's happening overnight, and I don't think it's going to happen all, you know, in a way that we can't ameliorate it and move forward in interesting ways together. It seems like a pretty good idea to start taking some systematic action towards relocalizing food production as much as we could, including in cities.
It would seem also America's love affair with lawns, you know, and the integration of those as, you know, as part of parks, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of that space is just given over to, you know, a monoculture.
Yeah. And it's, you know, lawns that require huge amounts of chemicals to keep them so pristine and strange looking. So, you know, I think everybody enjoys a little bit of lawn once in a while, and there's no reason to say all lawns have to be abolished. But to the notion that most space, you know, in suburbia and in major parks is given over to the European lawn, it's kind of bizarre, and I think we could definitely make better use of that land.
It was also intriguing. I got to visit Norway and Finland just a couple of years ago, and the roofs they have on some of the houses there where they have, you know, sod going mm-hmm. up a couple feet and stuff growing on that, and primarily used for a heating, you know, a buffer, insulation. But I was looking at that thinking, God, you could be growing stuff that you could be eating up there.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people talking about that in New York and in San Francisco, too, about starting really look at all that acreage, just empty rooftops that could be made into thriving farms as well. They actually have bee farmers on the top of houses in Lower East Side of Manhattan now. It's kind of interesting, considering that the bee populations are crashing, too.
I wanted to get back to, you mentioned software and the whole mm-hmm. Movement that's happening there. I was hoping you can expand on that, because that seems to be an area that the corporate America is challenging fairly vigorously.
Well, the open source and free software movements, you know, open source is already essentially a co-optation of the notion of free software. And it was created in order to create some legitimacy in the business world for using this different model of software. So the software world has evolved to a point where it's a little bit like a game of Texas Hold'em, where there's five cards out on the table and everybody knows what they are. That's what all the open source software is. And then the business model says, great, you know, let's do more and more of that, because it erodes the power of Microsoft or other companies that are tended towards monopolization and proprietary control over software. And so there's a move embraced by many, many smaller competitors who see that as a good strategy, as a way of opening up markets and a way of getting more niches in them and so on. And so sure enough, that's happened, and that a great deal of what's been produced in the last 15 years of open source has been paid for by corporations, as it turns out, because they saw that as that was useful to them. But the impetus for it in the first place, and then a great number of people who continue to add on and augment what's out there for us as individuals, are people who have these skills who refuse to reduce themselves to being merely remunerated by money and see themselves as, you know, engaged in a larger process of really trying to open up the world towards this notion of free and creating a spaces in which people can do things without the constraints of corporate domination or, you know, the propagandistic systems we live in or the government telling us what we can do or not do, et cetera. And that kind of impulse has created incredible amounts of resources for all of us to then express ourselves. So lots of us have blogs now, and all of us are posting photos to Flickr and are involved in endless email chats and conversations and, you know, instant messaging, et cetera, all of which has its origins in this kind of effort to create free space and opens. I mean, even the personal computer didn't come out of a corporate plan. It came out of a lot of tinkerers and garages thinking, you know what, there's no reason why we should leave giant corporations and the military to be the only ones having computers. Why don't we get some for the people? And I actually write about this in my chapter about the this group in Berkeley called the Community Memory Project, which I happened to work with back in 1979 and 1980. And they envision a great deal of what the internet has come to be in terms of what they thought they were creating. But they didn't believe at that point that there would be a personal computer in everybody's home. They thought that would never happen and that it would be creating these public computers where you could go and sit in a laundromat or a cafe and have access to everybody else, and then anybody could make the news. This was really the vision, was to change the media from being a couple of voices speaking to millions to being every voice speaking to every other voice. And really, the internet has evolved in that direction in a really interesting way. So there's this kind of open space that's really interesting, and it's still obviously rushing towards a commercialized model and largely commercialized already, but there are a lot of openings and a lot of spaces there that remain inspiring. And one of the things that happens is that a lot of the really talented programmers who are not satisfied with just reproducing profits for capital take their time and their energy outside of the market and produce really interesting tools for social movements. So one example I have in the book is this guy, Guillermo Payet, who was a Peruvian programmer who came up to do a work for IBM and then worked for a dot-com startup that he had, and then it crashed like everything. And while he was doing that, in his spare time and with his people that he was working with, he kind of encouraged them to help, and they were happy to do it. They started something called localharvest.org, which you can check out. And it's a system that creates that's a software tool for farmers, for small growers, and who are doing artisanal production and have old heirloom strains of fruits and vegetables and things that for which there's not a large market. And if they have to put it into the normal agribusiness model, they lose. Well, most farmers lose if they deal with agribusiness anyway. And so he created a system whereby they could connect directly with people who are interested in what they're growing and their markets without any middleman. And it was totally free on his part to create this resource. And he did it because he cared about good food. He came from Peru and they had good food, and he lived in Silicon Valley and they don't have good food. And he was really upset by that. And he wanted to figure out, how could I get connected to the local food systems and make it so that they can sustain themselves? And in some ways, he's very parallel to the slow food movement, which in the United States takes the form of essentially wealthy people indulging in foodie kind of politics and events, spending lots of money on expensive things. But it has its origins in real working class efforts in Italy and other parts of Europe to save the old ways of doing things, to save the old ways of making a certain sausage or a certain cheese or having this old orchard of pears that are totally heirloom that nobody remembers and bringing them back to life, but bringing them to the market. And it's kind of an irony for somebody like me who wants to overthrow markets and money to talk about these systems that essentially allow farmers to get money for their various limited production of sort of glamorous small things, you know, whatever they might be. But it's the point being that we're living in a world that's really destroying the biodiversity, not only of the general ecology of the planet, but specifically of agriculture. There used to be hundreds, in some cases thousands, of varieties of apples and pears and peaches and all these things, and now we're down to two or three or four. And that's very unsafe in the long term for the human species and probably for the planet to have reduced biodiversity that way. So this slow food movement understands that to combat that, you actually have to create markets for these small heirloom vegetables and fruits, because otherwise the farmers won't keep them going. So there's an interesting thing about sort of using the mechanisms in the short term as we move to a long-term society that's based on much greater diversity and much greater abundance.
So what do you say to people to get them moving in this direction that are, you know, basically bound by the current system that have to, you know?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. We all do. We all are bound, right? I mean, you know, I have bills to pay. I have to earn some money somehow. And so we all find what we can do, the best compromise we can make. And my little mantra on that is better than worse. You know, try to find something that's better rather than the thing that's worse. Try to make a better decision rather than a worse decision about at every moment where you have a choice. And, you know, if you're caught up in a world in which you're working three jobs to get by, you probably don't have a whole lot of time to do anything else. If you're working in one job where you get enough money from it, you probably can take some time to do other things as well. And a lot of what we do nowadays is we help each other steal time from our jobs. Like if we're at a big corporation especially, there's a lot of space usually to get away with things, whether it's having time for chatting with your friends on the phone or on the computer or messing around on the internet. Or more practically, writing a book or, you know, creating new projects that you're working on in your spare time, but then you can bring that into your work life as well. So there's ways you can start to divert resources, really importantly, from the kind of things we do for money. So there's all these little things you can do around that. Then there's also the time when we're not at work, which for many of us is, you know, different sizes of different availabilities and different amounts of energy that we have left over after we've earned our money. But in those other spaces is where I think people have been really innovative and interesting. And it's precisely when they're not being paid and when they're not working class, not reproducing capitalism on its own terms, that they're inventing all these new ways of doing things. And so the gardening movement was one example. Another really good example is the bicycling movement. I mean, bicycling's just expanded like crazy since the early 90s. And one of the reasons was Critical Mass, which I was part of the group of people who started the first one back there in San Francisco. But that's not the whole story. Critical Mass does create this amazing experience where you have hundreds, dozens, thousands of bicycles rolling through the streets together, reoccupying urban space, the city streets, for a completely different purpose, in which people are talking to each other and they're hearing the bells tinkling and they're having this different auditory experience. They're smelling the world differently. They're seeing the world differently. And they're talking to each other. I mean, how many places in the United States do people just talk to each other for the sheer joy of meeting somebody new and talking to them? It's almost always in a bar or a restaurant or some version or another where you buy something to be there. And if you're not buying something, you have no purpose to be there. And so this life, our lives have been reduced to endless streams of commercial transactions. And Critical Mass was an example of people coming together on the bicycle with a different idea about public space and a different idea about what it is to be cohabitants of an urban environment. And so, you know, obviously some people don't like it and have their criticisms of it, and that's fine, and I'd be happy to talk about that with anybody. But for purposes of this discussion, the interesting thing about Critical Mass is it's kind of a launching pad. It's a place where people networked and met each other in this free space with a new sense of what's possible about moving your body through the city, a new sense of how cities could be. And one of the most interesting things about all these initiatives in Nowtopia is how much it changes people's imaginations, how they think about what might be and what's possible. And so in the case of the bicycling movement, tons of women have been involved. There's all these bike zines going on. There's all these crazy cultural bike rides. I know just here yesterday in Seattle, you had a naked bike ride and people painted themselves quite beautifully. There, you know, all these, well, I saw quite a few people like that over the course of the day in this place that I was at. And then finally, you have the rise of the what's known as the DIY bike shop. And DIY, I'll just say a little bit behind that, too. You know, the DIY bike shop is basically a place where you go with your bicycle and you say, you know, my bike's, I got a flat or my brakes are broken. Can you fix it? And they look at you like, no, we don't fix bikes here. Sorry. But we'll show you how to fix your bike. And here's the tools and here's the stand and here's how you do it. And if you need me to stand next to you the whole time and help you do it, I'll do that. So there's a systematic community building thing going on around these DIY bike shops, and it's around the transfer of technological knowledge. It's around using the waste stream of wasted parts and broken bicycles that are endlessly thrown away on the curb by Americans who just think of them as toys and junk. And there's all these people who recognize, no, this is a huge transportation infrastructure at our disposal, really. It's being disposed of, but let's take it out of that stream. And instead of putting it in the landfill, let's reuse these things. And you have at least one or more of these bike shops that have emerged in almost every city in the United States in the last 10 years, mostly run by volunteers. There's very few people even getting wages out of these things, although one of their dramas is that as they succeed and they become more stable over time, then the normal problems of a small business begin to beset them with, you know, rent and wages and so on. But in any case, the bicycling movement's been one of the more interesting areas of expression of this DIY impulse. And the DIY, you know, obviously it can be reduced to this simple action of just fixing it yourself or doing your own gardening or what have you. But the deeper impulse of DIY is the refusal of corporate and governmental expertise and saying that what they tell us is not necessarily true at all. In fact, it's very often blatantly false. So one of the interesting examples of this going back in our recent history is the women's health movement, because women got together and started organizing themselves for their own health when they realized that normal mainstream medicine was just not going to meet their needs. And so now you have all these women's health clinics all over the country. This goes back to the 60s and 70s, you know, the rise of the legal right to abortion, the self-care around, you know, reproductive health. All these things are phenomena of a DIY movement of women for their own health care. Another great example, which we now have to reinvent, is the anti-nuclear movement. The nuclear was presented to everybody as though it was a fait accompli and there was no way around it and it was the obvious solution for all of our problems. Now they're talking that way again, but there's a whole lot of us out here, millions of us who know better and who spent a lot of time in the 1970s finding out that nuclear was a ridiculous way of boiling water. And there's a lot more efficient ways of producing the energy needs that we have before us. And so nuclear, you know, becomes a disaster on a bunch of different levels. And the kind of DIY sensibility that informed that was partly because we taught ourselves and we had all these study groups and affinity groups and direct action groups and so on that really developed the knowledge of what the real issues were around energy production and energy consumption, for that matter. But then also a number of people dropped out of the professional world. And we have this anti-professionalism phenomenon, which there you can find in every field, where people who are skilled and well-trained join the opposition. and realize that by going out and just keeping their mouth shut and doing their job and working for capital, they're actually causing many more problems than they can possibly justify to themselves. And instead, they take that time and technological expertise and contribute it to social movements who are in opposition to the agenda being presented from on high. So these are kind of examples of a DIY. We just had this in the Bay Area. They were going to spray the whole area for brown apple moths. An incredible social movement erupted in less than the last 3 months, and that they've just announced that they're not going to spray. And it's because so many people were up in arms about it and pushing back against it, even though they claimed it was totally safe. But people figured out that it wasn't. So this kind of DIY impulse, I think, is a really important part of our lives that we have to honor and expand.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Talking with Chris Carlson, he is author of the new book, Nowtopia. And in addition to your book, do you have a website people can go to?
Yeah, my website. I have one under my name, which leads to everything else. It's chriscarlson.com, and Carlson spelled with two S's. There's also nowtopia.org, and you can get the book at akpress.org.
Chris Carlson, interviewed by Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio.
I hope Chris Carlson has given a practical and present angle on this otherwise rather theoretical, perhaps even speculative show, looking at a range of activities which, in themselves perhaps less important, put them together, and they show that people are breaking out of the logic of the market. People treasure the parts of their lives that they decide for themselves, and I couldn't agree more that large amounts of human activity is not even useless, but worse than useless. The armaments industry, a lot of people driving to work to do things they don't want to do, to get this thing called money, which we know is deliberately scarce because it's lent into existence from banks who want more. So I'm feeling that just as Marshall Rosenberg talked about the inevitable consequences of pushing people around and forcing them to do things they don't want to do, that the centralized hierarchs, the system, is building an ever larger resentment against it. And yes, young people are born into a system where they are told there is no choice but working for the man, and yet that doesn't stop their resentment. The vision of young people that a more beautiful world is possible, to quote Charles Eisenstein, who himself talks about how close humanity is to a rejection of the fear and scarcity-based model, to the realization that we already have all we need. Are we yet ready to agree to a different set of rules? I think discontentment with the current regime is building, and they're becoming increasingly desperate in their use of fear, whether it's fear of terrorists or global climate change. So at one point I'd like to clarify, Chris Carlson said, of course everybody needs money. Well, we know that's not true for a certain proportion in the global south who grow their own food, but it's also not true for an increasing number of individuals in the developed world, so-called. If you Google on lifestyle gift economists, you'll find your way to wiki.gifteconomy.org, where there's a list of people going back to 1953 who made a conscious decision to opt out of the moneyed world and to live in the US and in Europe and in other places without using money. I would not dismiss these people as mere curiosities, but find their motives and lifestyles very interesting and with a potential to spread, especially given the communications technology which has put them in touch. If we are to just agree to a different set of rules, then doing so globally through the internet would seem to be the most plausible way for this to happen. How could people most effectively break the fallacious connection between wealth and power? Well, I'm imagining a piece of software that allowed them to influence, not control, but influence other people without using wealth. That might be, for example, that they could request that somebody come round and do something for them, not by using money, but by directly communicating to someone else. And how would they feel if in the morning they got up and saw a list of requests from other people, and instead of going to work for the man, they made their own decision as to what they'd like to do that day. And many people may not yet be ready for this, but considering some people have already given up money, they might be very keen to embrace this solution. Let's not underestimate the depth of the connection between wealth and power in people's mind, in their world view, how those two are equated, how many people do allow the hyper-rich to make decisions because they're hyper-rich. So, to underline the point, let's hear a couple of minutes from the interview we heard 2 weeks ago by George Draffen. And notice the astuteness of his later analysis about power as compared to how easily he equates wealth and power, making the point that for so many people, these two thoughts are interchangeable.
Well, they do have more power, and I mean, clearly power is unequal. wealth and power are at record imbalance right now, and you look at what the wealthy and of the world, what is it, 300 billionaires, the 300 richest people in the world have more wealth than half of the world's population. And with wealth, comes political power and technological power and ability to make decisions. So power is clearly imbalanced. But what I find most useful and most inspiring in my own work is to realize that there's not a certain amount of power in the world, and some people have it and some people don't. The power that I can exercise is up to me, and I can have infinitely more freedom and power over my life than I can imagine right now. But I can only have it if I take responsibility and exercise it. Mm-hmm. Power is not granted by someone else. It comes from my own doing, and so how far I can go and what I can do and what I can imagine is up to me and not up to George Bush.
Now, of course, that's an insightful and also a dangerous analysis of what is legal power by George Draffen. It's whatever people will let you get away with. I've so far focused on economic power, but I think it'd be wrong to say that was what Ivan Illich was talking about, because that's really just another side of legal power. Remember, state-sanctioned, centrally issued fiat currency draws its vitality from the ability to be used to pay debts, which are legally enforceable, that's a government-controlled monopoly, the court system, and the ability to be acceptable for taxes, which too is a government monopoly. What is legal power? The ability to use prisons, to use the police, to use those armed forces of the state, manifest the power in that way. Now, why are people engaged in that employ? Could that persist in the absence of a centrally backed economic system? I think it's a very moot point. What about the power that people get from having guns? Well, let's have another couple of minutes from Marshall Rosenberg on this.
So we want children, the same thing we want to teach adults. Institutions can't make you do anything. Other people can't make you do anything. No human being has ever done anything they didn't choose to do. A Palestinian in the village of Hebron disagreed with me one time. He said, "I don't agree with you, Marshall, that we only choose to do... Where was my choice 2 days ago? A soldier puts a gun at my head and says, 'Take off your clothes or I'll shoot you.' Where was my choice?" It seems pretty obvious to me. You had a choice of whether to take off your clothes or not. He laughed. He said, "Okay, I got your point. I chose not to take off my clothes. I chose..." That soldier knew I didn't have a gun. He was doing this to dishonor me. I chose to risk my life to protect my honor. Okay, so I'm not saying we always like the choices we have, but nobody can make us do anything we don't choose to do. So I said, "Apparently the soldier also chose not to shoot you, or else he was a very poor shot." My children taught me this about nobody does anything they don't choose to do. From the time they were 2 years old, they educated me that I couldn't make them do anything. All I could do is make them wish they had. And then they taught me another lesson, that any time I would do that, they would make me wish I hadn't made them wish they had. They taught me that violence creates violence.
Now, it would be naive to suggest that those people who are habitually violent to others will suddenly wake up one day and decide not to be. However, I think fast transition is actually very possible. Firstly, because human nature is not red in tooth and claw, based on survival of the fittest, certainly not to the extent that our society believes. That's largely because it's based on psychopathic values, principally through the economic system, but also through a lot of other systems, all of which are liable to change if a decentralized, bottom-up communication system puts people in touch with what they really want. Secondly, internet communication and surveillance technology is making it harder and harder to do things and have the perpetrators unnoticed. So, for example, the September 11th false flag attack might have seemed like it was going to disappear down the memory hole when it was carried out, but increasingly is coming to the fore. Now, maybe it's just me and the people I know, but maybe awareness of the psychopathic nature of the system is actually spreading, and I believe it's the latter, as we see what it's doing to rainforests, what it's doing to people, and the effects on the environment. Now, this is a sports commentator that I remember from my youth, and this is his thoughts on how the system itself predates on people and the nature of power in the modern nation state.
This is a point I think is very important to stress to those in uniform and to those in the dark suits in government who are serving this system while not actually instigating it, they're serving it. You have no power. I don't care if you're in the military. I don't care if you've got how many kind of stars on your uniform. I don't care what level of the police force you're in. I don't care if you're doing roadblocks. I don't care if you're okay, put it in the wardrobe, where's your power? Go and get another job without that uniform, where's your power? You have no power. You are employed to animate that uniform, which is an extension of the state, and that's all you are, and therefore you are expendable. While you give your soul away, while you give your mind away, while you give your morals and decency away, advancing this fascist dictatorship, you will be okay with the fascists that you're serving. But your children and your grandchildren have to live in the world you are creating. And one day you're going to have to understand that, and I don't envy you that moment, because it's going to be horrific when it dawns upon you the world that you've actually created. The people in uniform and the dark suits that administer the system while not being the originators of it, they have to start breaking ranks, okay? Get some backbone, open your mind, look at what's going on, and get some freaking backbone before you administer and impose and enforce a world that will be grotesque for your children and grandchildren. In fact, not even that, for yourself.
Now, I do still meet people who question 9/11 and say, why would they kill their own people? But by and large, this is understood that the American citizens are not their own people in the eyes of the people who organized September the 11th. As Ivan Illich said, the idea of citizenship is fast losing credibility, and rightly so, if the president says it's his right to assassinate anybody, including American citizens, if he thinks that this is the right thing to do. For reviewing the laws here, let's hear George Drafton's take on this.
The reliance on legislation, on the reliance on someone else is going to pass a law that will help protect my civil rights. The whole idea of privacy never never arose. Privacy was never necessary until power relations were unequal. And then suddenly I wanted certain areas of my life to be under my control. So I said, that's my private, you know, that's my private privilege. But why is that even necessary unless I've already given up my own power to someone else?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. I wanted to say one thing that I got from the book is that I found it interesting that a high-ranking security chief in South Africa's apartheid regime, his greatest fear was not economic or industrial sabotage, but that people would be convinced to disregard law and order. And that was actually his greatest fear, he confessed later on. And I wonder if you can maybe talk about, like, when people hear all kinds of stuff like this, the question that people end up on is, well, what do we do? And for those people out there who are thinking, what do we do? And most of us already know what to do. But I'm curious to hear perspective on that. Like, what ways are there out of this machine?
Yeah. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, another political scientist and philosopher in the 1700s, wrote that man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. The brain may become paralyzed and the individual still live. A man may remain an imbecile and still live. Slaves lose everything in their chains, even the desire of escaping them. If there are slaves, it is because they've enslaved themselves. The force made the first slaves, and cowardice perpetuates the situation. And there's another writer even earlier in the 1500s, La Boetie, and he wrote an essay that's just incredibly inspiring because he points out that everywhere kings and generals, whoever's, you know, think of the most powerful people on earth, and how do they get their power? They're still people. I mean, in the end, we are still living with the same capabilities as those people in village life where everyone had equal power. I ultimately have as much power as Bill Gates or George Bush. It's the extent to which someone else has more power than I do is dependent on me granting them that power. Ultimately, you know, George Bush is a human with with one head and two arms and two legs. If he's going to send people to their death, it depends on soldiers obeying his commands. If the soldiers in Iraq, we've got, what, 150,000 troops? But how many millions, how many tens of millions of people are there in Iraq? So people are ruled by their own consent. And that's true whether you're talking about the ballot box or you're talking about machine guns. Ultimately, soldiers have to obey orders. The population has to obey soldiers. And I think that's on the political level, on a legal level, on the administrative levels, which is where our minds usually are, that's not a very satisfying answer. You say, well, that's preposterous. George Bush has, you know, led this country into war. He's got power. Well, 2/3 of Americans were in favor of the invasion of Iraq. And those numbers have slipped as the casualties have gone up, as the costs have, become clearer. Those numbers have slipped. But 2/3 of Americans were in favor of invading Iraq. So, do we blame George Bush or do we take responsibility for ourselves? And I think that's really why telling people that they already have freedom, they already have power, is scary. It's not a satisfying answer. We want to hear that somebody else with power is going to pass a law that's going to protect me. I don't want to hear that I'm already free and that I bear, responsibility for living that way. We don't want to hear it, and we've got a million political and economic and social reasons why we can't exercise freedom and responsibility. But that's basically what freedom is. Security is slavery. It's slavery to the rules. It's slavery to the military. It's slavery to surveillance. It's counterintuitive, but secure, living with an obsession for security is to condemn yourself to being a slave to a machine and to the social relations that machine requires. And freedom is responsibility. It means I've got to take responsibility for what I do for a living, for what I consume, for how I treat my neighbors, for how I elect my leaders and what I allow them to do. And, people shy away from that. People really like leaders and project their power onto leaders, which, of course, is where that power comes from. Mm-hmm. The power that George Bush or Bill Gates or Saddam Hussein that their power is everyone's power that's been projected. It's the public's power that the public has projected onto that leader. And leaders are not in power for a day longer than the public submits to them.
Now, as impressed as I am with Draffin's analysis, I think he's drawing too much on a traditional notion of leadership and elections. I consider a system in the future where people can lead on one issue and follow on another. The same way, for example, I post one website and I read other websites. I was looking for a suitable last word, and I just think we should listen to Ivan Illich, his original predictions, in the light of what we've heard. And if you want to contact me, if that means something else to you, then I'd love to hear from you.
The credibility of the world constructed with the idea of citizenship, of responsibility, of power, of equality, of need, claim, and entitlement. The credibility of these as ideals for which it is worthwhile to consecrate your life is declining, in my opinion, very fast. Most people see this as a serious danger, which it is, to the survival of a democratic order. I want to suggest the possibility of seeing it as the end of an epoch, just like the Roman Empire, as a time of Augustine, and as an entirely new access, credibility, ease of moving into the world of conspiratio.
This episode and all previous episodes are available from the archive at unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
Renegade economists Marilyn Waring, Kate Raworth, and Elena Ostrom, a TUC Radio miniseries on how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. Marilyn Waring critiques the GDP. Safe drinking water counts for nothing. A pollution-free environment counts for nothing. Even some people, namely women, count for nothing. This according to the United Nations System of National Accounts, the SNA. They set the standard and impose economic and budgetary decisions for almost 200 countries. The SNA produces the GDP, the gross domestic product, that allegedly measures well-being within a country. However, war and catastrophes, deforestation and mining show up as beneficial for the economy under the GDP. Marilyn Waring, former New Zealand MP, now professor, writer, and goat farmer, explained this in her book, Counting for Nothing. She gave a 30-year update at the University of Alberta, Canada, in November of 2016. Marilyn Waring began by honoring the ancestors of the First Nations peoples of New Zealand, where she lives, and Alberta, Canada, where she spoke.
Tēnā koutou, kia ora tātou katoa. Let me begin by acknowledging the First Nations peoples who have been the successive guardians of the land of Edmonton and the tangata whenua of Aotearoa, New Zealand, where I'm standing. 30 years ago, I was working on the final draft of my book, Counting for Nothing. In this, I analysed how gross domestic product, GDP, derived from something called the United Nations System of National Accounts, imposed an ideology of applied patriarchy on the measurement of economic progress. While I was chairing the Public Expenditure Committee of the New Zealand Parliament, I discovered that this system had a set of rules that excluded women's unpaid work of all kinds, voluntary and community work, unpaid productive work, reproductive work, subsistence work, and household work from these accounts. And these rules also excluded our beautiful ecosystem, except, of course, when natural resources were mined or forested or harvested, deleted, depleted, extracted, exploited. At the same time, this accounting framework seemed to have no debit side. So as long as there were legal or illegal market transactions, for example, trafficking in people or drugs, this was all good for growth. Well, I thought these SNA, well, I'll shorten it to that, these SNA rules sounded very strange. And I asked our Treasury to get a copy of them for me. After a week or so, they advised me that there didn't appear to be either the 1953 or the 1968 version of the rules in New Zealand. Well, in those years, I laboured under a little inferiority complex vis-a-vis Australia, and I said, then please get them for me from Canberra. And soon the reply came back, there's no copy in Australia either. I had no idea I was asking for encyclopedic volumes filling many shelves. If those of you who have seen Terry Nash's movie, Who's Counting, will remember when I get into the library and confront those shelves. But I did know there was something very odd about an international set of rules governing such a central aspect of economic decision making when nobody needed to read them. Well, I retired from the New Zealand Parliament in interesting circumstances in 1984, and I decided I would go to New York to read these volumes, and I had no idea what lay ahead. I discovered a system which claimed that, quote, primary production and the consumption of their own produce by non-primary producers is of little or no importance. End quote. Well, every woman I knew was classified as a non-primary producer in all or some of her life. Wow. Is of little or no importance. So these rules established a boundary of production to determine what was and what was not to be counted in the gross domestic product, the GDP. For what reason? Convenience, the rules explained. Non-primary producers were described as inactive and unoccupied. There were some sectors where non-monetary production was recognised in the 1953 rules. For example, in agriculture, forestry, hunting, mining, quarrying, fishing, rather obviously mostly stereotypical male work. In the 1968 revision, this was expanded to include building and construction, the processing of primary products such as cloth, oil, butter, or furniture. But the revision continued to exclude the carriage of water, weeding of primary productive land crops, which was always women's work, the collection of firewood or the manufacture of dung patties for fuel, subsistence crop production, and household activities. What was clear by 1986, as I worked on the book, was that moving the boundary of production was not reflected in the new construction of national income accounts for many reasons. The United Nations System of National Accounts claimed its outstanding use has been in connection with public policy. It also claimed that per capita GDP was the very best indicator of economic welfare. As a parliamentarian, I'd represented a rural constituency in a so-called developed country. Budgetary investment in the agricultural sector was frequently justified on the basis of per capita increases in production. I knew none of this was accurate. Women and children worked very hard in my rural area, and the per capita assumptions attributed only to the man of the household on the farm were seriously overstated, and this data was sadly astray. There was a further change in the boundary of production in 1993. The production boundary was now pushed out to include the carriage of water, crop storage, repairs to buildings if they were made by the owner, wood carrying, weaving baskets and mats, making clay pots and plates, weaving textiles, making furniture, and dressmaking. Subsistence, midwifery, and funeral services were excluded because they could not be resold. The 1993 edition no longer boasted that the SNA and derived data were a crucial indicator of well-being. I could tell my book had been influential, but the work that keeps the world turning was not counted. The main categories of domestic services were excluded. Wherever we've had sanctions, wherever peoples are nomadic, for example, Mongolia, where there are or have been wars, some of which, for example, in Afghanistan, I counted in my prologue 30 years ago, where there have been major natural disasters, such as Nepal's earthquake, or where the resources needed to conduct valid and reliable data collection have never been available in the nation states of most of the Pacific. We do not have GDP data that means anything. Experts from the World Bank, writing in 2015, described the challenge of improving agricultural statistics worldwide as daunting. But when data sets continue to miss smallholder agricultural productivity, we miss a key to reducing poverty and enhancing food security. Well, now we're all in the realm of the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs. And Target 8 of the SDGs is, quote, to sustain per capita economic growth in accordance with national circumstances, and in particular, at least 7% gross domestic product growth per annum in the least developed countries. Well, I could flippantly say, but I'm sure I'd be right, if you measured the informal sector, you won't have any difficulty achieving that. But nothing will have changed. You'll just have started seeing all the other half of the population doing their work. The first indicator is annual growth rate of real GDP per capita. The second target is to achieve higher levels of economic productivity. The next indicator is annual growth rate of real GDP per employed person. The commentary notes that, quote, the employment estimates are sensitive to undercoverage of informal or underground activities. The ILO has data on the share of informal employment for only 62 of at least 178 member countries of the ILO. What is all this nonsense about? Why doesn't someone tell the truth about the data that will be used to measure these goals. Recent work in Nepal by ActionAid has shown women working 15 and a half hours a day in paid work, subsistence farming, collecting fuel and water, housework, food preparation, cleaning, and caring for children and adults. In the same activities, men worked 8 hours and spent more time than women sleeping and in self-care. Now let me move to the issue of environment. And if I were writing another edition of the book, I would be using global warming and climate change brought about by carbon emissions and pollutions in many forms as key examples. I'd outline the transnational effects of these, just like the acid rain and ozone layer depletion examples I used 30 years ago. I would survey the floods, typhoons, droughts, and record temperatures recorded all over the planet, the shrinking Arctic ice, the vast ice sheets of the Antarctic breaking apart. The number of environmentally displaced persons worldwide is projected to rise to 150 million by the year 2050. In Tuvalu, a small nation state in the North Pacific with 11,000 inhabitants, most of the 26 square kilometre island nation is less than a metre above sea level. Salt water is contaminating food and scarce fresh water. Tuvalu's chosen plan of action is international migration of the entire nation. The people of Tuvalu and at least two other nations, which will be entirely inundated, Kiribati and the Marshall Islands, do not qualify as refugees under the 1967 United Nations Protocol. When they are forced to leave their home, Tuvaluans will have no remedy against carbon emitters who have removed their fundamental human rights to life, health, food, and self-determination. Climate change raises the question of whether any of the United Nations human rights instruments can address these losses of fundamental rights. When countries sink in their entirety, then not only will people lose their nation and their seat in the United Nations General Assembly, but they will also lose their territorial waters and their 200-mile economic zone, which has been the source of employment and national income. I'm sure the Chinese, who have a recent history of building up and occupying low-lying atolls and islands, will be watching and waiting. And people from the Cataract Islands off Papua New Guinea, where a Canadian mining company is mining gold at a depth of 5 kilometres, just by the way, became some of the first climate change refugees. And there is an ongoing evacuation of 2,500 people to Bougainville. But this is not an easy resettlement. Land on Bougainville is communally owned. As any woman who is the victim of domestic violence and who lives on communally owned land can tell you, when you are beaten or when there is a problem, there is nowhere else to go. Now, growing pollution has been a process of major deterioration in my lifetime, all as a result of this pathological race to record growth in the GDP. Whether it's the rivers and waterways of the New Zealand environment being destroyed by dairy farming, the places in Asia where I have worked in the past, in Myanmar, China, Nepal, Indonesia, Bangladesh, where I no longer go because I cannot breathe. There's the mindless trophy hunting of endangered animals or obnoxious slaughter of rhino for so-called aphrodisiacs or of elephant for ivory. The destruction of forests for logging, the ugly flattening of the habitat of orangutans for oil palm production, there's poaching and illegal fishing. The Pacific Ocean is expected to operate as a sump for the highly radioactive water that continues to pour into the Pacific from Fukushima, with isotopes entering the Pacific food chain. Long-lived industrial pollutants drain into our rivers and run to the sea. Governments lie to their citizens. Corrupt politicians fill their trust accounts with the graft permitting these behaviours, and our planet is going to hell. As I write this address, news bulletins advised that schools in Delhi were closed as the most harmful pollutants, particulate matter 2.5, had reached more than 16 times the safe limit. Pollution contributed to 600,000 deaths per year, more than the total for malaria and HIV/AIDS combined. Meanwhile, inside the environmental accounting framework, the expert group makes it clear that the values present inside the accounts must be for market, not social values. At the same time, we have huge volatility of asset values where the valuation relies exclusively on the current commodity prices or their expected values in the future. Well, what we need are the descriptions of the physical characteristics of the ecosystem, not some abstracted nonsense for economists to play with. Now, economics, some of you might have noticed, in the last few years has discovered, quote, social capital, end quote. Now, there's actually a huge discomfort for me in using that term, social capital, environmental resources. This language continues this colonizing and propagandistic goal of economics, channeling how people and our ecosystem are abstracted for market equations, as if that's the only source of value. Well, one of the things that social capital needs is people to have relationships. Now, the wondrous world of economics omits to figure out just how these agents of social capital come into the world. The SNA has never managed to cope with reproduction, except when it enters the market. So biological reproduction, pregnancy, giving birth, lactation, motherhood, are all externalities not worthy of mention unless there's a need for intervention by others who are in paid work. If you manage a non-market pregnancy, you're at leisure for 9 months. The best investment in social capital begins with a child breastfed for 6 months, as this makes such a difference for future health, brain development, and attachment. This is a trade-off neither governments nor markets seem to understand. But I checked last night. You can buy, sell, or donate breast milk on eBay. Julie Smith's been working on valuing breast milk and having it included, as it should be, in the Australian GDP. Breast milk totally fits the SNA description of primary production. This has no value in the GDP, but the GDP loves breasts when they're part of the vast international pornography industry. One of the chapters in the book was called The Value of Death, and in the movie it was called Making a Killing. Killing people and preparing to kill people has become much more valuable in the last 30 years. The annual Global Peace Index estimates that conflict, terrorism, and political instability are costing the global economy $13.6 trillion US dollars a year. As if the grotesque amounts of military production already treated as growth were not enough, ballistic missiles provide an ongoing service and mothers of teething children are unoccupied. Well, you can work the system to register a weapons-based increase in the GDP, but you can't count breast milk as primary production. Charles Aspin, who's senior administrator at the OECD National Accounts and Financial Statistics Division, still thinks the volume measure of GDP per capita can be used as a surrogate measure of well-being. Here's the point, and let's get it really clear. GDP has never been adequately measured, and it is no different today. It's a complete dog's breakfast, which is unfair to the dog. In 2009, after the global economic crisis, French President Sarkozy set up a commission on the measurement of economic performance and social progress, led by Joseph Stiglitz, Amartya Sen, and Jean-Paul Fitoussi. Its key message, quote, "The time is ripe for our measurement system to shift emphasis from measuring economic production to measuring people's well-being," end quote. Well done, boys, just 20 years late. The latest nightmare is that the same approach is being used for well-being. The good old Central Committee at the OECD is determining what the colonial, monocultural, Western characteristics of well-being are, homogenizing them, as I detailed, with respect to pollution, and imposing them on everybody because we need to be compared. As the good old Monty Python line had it, "And now for something completely similar." Now, there is some good stuff happening. In New Zealand, Statistics New Zealand has worked with Tangata Whenua, developed in consultations with Māori communities over 5 years, indicators of Māori well-being. These do not look like the OECD Central Committee's well-being. Māori language, connection to hapū, extended family, and iwi, tribe, engagement in Māori culture, regular visits to ancestral marae. You can find these on the Statistics New Zealand website. And Canada, you have contributed a significant amount to our alternatives for policy making based on reality. I've mentioned that early work with Statistics Canada on the census and in time use. And I remember Statistics Canada also being involved with the Nova Scotian Genuine Progress Indicators, GPI Atlantic. Ron Coleman led these. In my visits to Canada, I began to read of a woman called Maud Barlow, whose decades of work on food and the right to water has been an inspiration. I think she's a Canadian national treasure. Meanwhile, in Alberta at the Pembina Institute, Mark Anielski was constructing the GPI for Alberta. Mark, I still remember the story you told me of waiting to see Paul Martin when he was Minister of Forests, and there was a First Nations man in the outer office too. And he asked you what you were doing, and he drew a circle with his talking stick. And from this, you developed the use of radar diagrams in the four well-being areas in Alberta. That radar diagram approach has been picked up and used again and again. And the great benefit of this approach is their open architecture, where any new indicator can be added as soon as we have a benchmark and another year. Mark, I also honour your work in Nunavut, where a fifth well-being, the spiritual, was added, and your incredible work with the Indigenous peoples of the Boreal Forest. And of course, I'm here, and with you too, to honour Parkland's 20 years of contribution to alternative ways of seeing and being in the world, of working with reality, not theory. Canada, it seems to me you have strong community-based foundations for producing the data and descriptions that enable visibility for all people and for all elements of our ecosystem without the need to abstract all this to dollar values. 78 men have won the Nobel Prize in Economics. In 2009, not surprising really, in that year they couldn't find a man. In 2009, Eleanor Ostrom became the first woman to win. Ostrom's work investigated how communities who had resources in common ownership, forests, lakes, communally owned grazing land, for example, cooperated to share resources sustainably and equitably. The award statement for Eleanor Ostrom begins, As a political scientist, Eleanor Ostrom's research methods differed from how most economists worked. Usually, they start with an hypothesis, an assumption of reality, which is then put to the test. Eleanor Ostrom started with an actual reality instead. I've spent 30 years turning the UNSNA on its head and shaking it about. It has disintegrated, in fact, if it ever had form. The work of most of the people on the planet that falls inside the production boundary still isn't counted, regardless of the rules. The vast sector ignored outside this boundary means that the central measurement is very far from recording the everyday reality of most people and most economies. It's an appalling misuse of propaganda masquerading as ideology and science. It's a malevolent farce. And the sooner we can be free of its central and controlling influence, the better for all people and the planet. Kia ora.
That was an excerpt of a 50-minute speech by Marilyn Waring. 30 years later, are we still counting for nothing? She's a former New Zealand MP, now professor of public policy at Auckland University, writer and goat farmer. Her book, Counting for Nothing, influenced a generation of social justice renegade economists.
And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.ca. It's no longer cfmu.mcmaster.ca, and the new website is accessible on all digital platforms that we know of. So we're really excited to be able to offer not only Hamilton, but the rest of the world our digital content. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Danny Haiphong, and he's a Vietnamese-American activist and political analyst in the Boston area. He writes for Black Agenda Report and other publications, and we're interviewing him about a very recent article about The Intercept. I think we have Danny on the line. Danny, thanks very much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've just got my tablet out here, and I'm pulling up your article. It's has the nice title here, The Intercept's Attack on the Oppressed is Why I Write. And yes, we certainly have an issue of The Intercept's coverage, not only in this month's reporting, but in the past 5 years, I would say, on Syria. You've chosen to focus on particular problems, a very problematic approach that The Intercept has adopted recently. We can talk about that, but I thought you had a very interesting opening premise. That is, people have been coming up to you and asking you, you know, why do you write? Why do you do all this writing for Black Agenda Report and stuff when there's so much organizing work to do? And it just seems to me you can't even know what to do in terms of organizing if you haven't analyzed the issues. And on an issue like what U.S. foreign policy and what they're doing to other countries or what they're saying about other countries, it's extremely important to know what's going on, isn't it?
It is. There is a profound state of political confusion, I feel, in the U.S. and the Western world in particular, the imperialist centers of the world, and that has necessitated, I think, a more intense need for political education and for those who have been studying the issues and who have been also organizing, because I believe that those who study these problems, unless you have no problem with them or benefit from them, you're most likely compelled to want to do something about them. So I believe that writing and political education, as writing and media activity often falls into, are deeply connected to organizing. So what we see now is that there is such a profound state of political confusion on the ideological level in the U.S., in the West, that the issue and the question of Syria, as well as many of the wars, the vast war machine that the U.S. and the West oversee, are not really on the agenda of much of the much of what calls itself the political movement today. So, you know, I feel like it's a pretty ridiculous statement to even attempt to justify the need for one action over another, in this case, some other form of political activity over writing. I think that there shouldn't be no explanation required as to why we need a whole a multitude of activities and people who are partaking in them around these crucial questions that ultimately, you know, point to class struggle and, you know, the need for a revolutionary transformation, which takes a whole lot of strategies to carry out.
Yes. Certainly there's been an upsurge in activism in the last few years, but it does seem as if we're starting from ground zero in terms of political theory. And as you point out, it is a time of profound political confusion, and perhaps we can get to that in more detail later. But I thought we'd talk about your article, the article addressing claims made in The Intercept. I think your article was very timely. A few people have written about this particularly egregious article, and I'm glad that people react so quickly now and wish that we had been able to do so 5 years ago when this all started. Your article, you're talking about a very disturbing article. It's by Miriam Elba, and she's trying to conflate support for Syria's sovereignty and self-determination with support for white nationalism and fascism. It seems to me that a large part of the basis for her argument is that the Syrian government is trying to build a so-called monolithic society based on ethno-nationalism. So, you know, it's a society that is, you know, quote, spiritually, socially, and politically, end quote, brooking no diversity. I mean, that's what she's putting forward. I'm wondering, even there, isn't there problems with that argument?
Yes. There's so many problems with the argument. I mean, there's so much that I dissect from this particular piece, which I feel Mary Melba wrote in order to access a lot of the benefits of all of this clickbaity material that is disseminated online by so-called lefty journals and sources, which are seeking to have a headline as well as content that will draw as many readers as possible into their website. And I feel like what is done here in this piece is that Miriam Elba makes this conflation between Assad and Syria with white nationalism to take advantage of this upsurge, which has two sides to it, this upsurge against white nationalism and white supremacy in the United States. On the one hand, you have Trump's overt rhetorical white supremacy and white nationalism in terms of political language, which has angered many people. And then you have the other side of it, where this idea of white nationalism is looked through such a narrow lens that it is ultimately used to demonize any political alternative to the system as a whole. It becomes a smokescreen for what is actually happening beneath the surface with the entire imperialist system. So she does something that's very convenient and will get her a lot of readers and will be very popular on social media, for example, where social media is also controls a lot of content and upholds things that talk about how terrible Russia is, how terrible Syria is, while suppressing a lot of content that attempts to defend these states from imperialist attack. And we could go on and on and on about the ways that Elba does this.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is not, it's not unique what she's doing. And you see the whole U.S. media, the liberal part of it, saying, you know, Trump is like Kim Jong-il, or, you know, Trump is like Syria, like Assad. Trump is like whatever we don't like, whatever, you know, everyone hates Trump. So he's like the other bête noirs of the United States. And they make these false comparisons. That's part of it. But it's even more disgusting, as you point out, because many people are rightfully upset with what Trump supporters have been doing with their marches and their racism and so on. But Elba is trying to turn this disgust against Trump, not against the U.S. state, the powerful Trump administration, but against a country that's being targeted by that powerful state. So they're smearing the nationalism of an oppressed country as if it's equivalent to the conditions of political decay that exist in the United States.
Right. And this is a critical problem because it exposes the level of political development among those who are reading this and accepting it as fact. I mean, when you have someone who is claiming an Arab nationalist state, a state that Stephen Gowans claims and proves very in much detail that arose from the national liberation movements of the 20th century, which had their target of as imperialism. That's what they were targeting, colonialism. Syria used to be a French colony. Not many people like to mention that when talking about Syria, when they have war maneuvers on their mind. So what's happening here is that this notion of fascism, this notion of white nationalism, these ideas are becoming meaningless because folks like Elba and The Intercept and all these pseudo-left journals have decided that it is okay to completely distort history and outright insult oppressed people all over the world who have formed national liberation movements like Syria and have similarly won power. And those that do not have power to determine their destinies that are still struggling against imperialist forces, basically insulting, demeaning, and ultimately forwarding just another variant of white supremacy against oppressed people around the world by saying that their rightful leaders and that their rightful political parties that they have decided are best to create a more just future for them are somehow fascist and white nationalists. And we should, you know, source check what Elba uses, the sources that she uses in the article, where one of them is an Atlantic article that uses a fellow named Ephraim Zuroff, the executive director of a large Israeli NGO. This Zionist NGO is pretty notorious for basically acting as a public relations organization for the crimes of the Zionist state of Israel. The same figure also served as an advisor for the Rwandan government right after the so-called genocide that occurred there, where he was assisting the government of Rwanda under Paul Kagame in figuring out how to commit a genocide in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which Black Agenda Report talks a lot about, and how that genocide has murdered 6 million Congolese since 1996 with the help of U.S. and Western aid, as well as Israeli aid to that government, so the Rwandan government. So to equate the Syrian government and the Syrian people with white nationalism and fascism is quite ironic, given the fact that she uses a white nationalist and imperialist and arguably a fascist to justify her arguments, while completely ignoring so many of the corporate sources that have basically proven her argument completely wrong, whether we're looking at the New York Times, Reuters, BBC, everywhere. And the corporate press has had pieces here and there detailing how the U.S. and its Western partners, as well as its Gulf monarch partners, have been the primary bankrollers of the jihadist and terrorist support for those forces that are wreaking havoc in Syria. And we can go on and on and on. But the biggest issue, in my opinion, is how Elba and The Intercept have negated history and have attempted to suppress the legitimate and genuine history that everyone should know about countries around the world and people around the world that have successfully fought back against imperialism or are trying to defend gains that have been made, real material gains. Syria was one of the most developed nations in that region, free health services, free education. I've met Syrians who fight here in Boston who have told me, you know, they got their doctorate degree for free and they can't understand why the United States makes doctors spend almost $1 million just to get an education. So, you know, not to mention the solidarity that is given to Palestinian and Iraqi refugees who have been the victims of war for decades. So all of this is completely negated, and instead we have a narrative that is not just Elba's. She's using one that has been used by many sources that call themselves the left, Jacobin. We can go on and on and on about the various sources, but these so-called left sources have adopted a narrative that basically says that any oppressed people that fights for their self-determination can at any time be called a dictatorship, a brutal dictatorship, a human rights violator, a genocide, or, as we see now in 2016 and on with the Trump administration, fascist and white nationalist. Just another way to brand what a lot of imperialist victims have been called in order to justify their destruction.
Well, of course, that is, in fact, what's happening. And you look at countries that have a proud history of resistance to imperialism, to white nationalist, you know, U.S. white supremacist imperialism. I'm talking about countries like Vietnam or Korea or Cuba or Zimbabwe and others, including Syria and Libya. And in all cases, they're called, you know, dictators and tin pot dictators, including by people who think they're leftist. They use chauvinist language, tin pot dictator, strongman, authoritarian, oriental despot, etc. They paint that picture. Meanwhile, these are countries trying to get out of a yoke of colonialism, Syria being among them. And of course, the forces that are fighting against the Syrian government, the ones backed by the West openly, are the ones that fly the three-star flag of the colonial administration. So the people fighting to overthrow the Syrian state are holding up the flag of the colonial French Syrian entity. They're saying, this is what we want to bring back. We want to bring back a Syria that is prostrate and under direct Western control. So we have to be especially sensitive to these issues, because despite all the, you know, in the academy, the talk about post-colonialism and how to be sensitive and everything like that, we are entering, or we are in a pronounced period of neo-colonialism, where there's the reoccupation by the West of countries, you know, like Libya, for example, and they're in Syria now as well. And they want to change these governments. So, you know, we need to stand up for these countries that have a legitimate right to defend themselves and to have borders and militaries and sovereignty and so on. And all of those things are demonized in ways that, let's face it, if ISIS or Al-Qaeda were operating the way they do in Syria, but in some neighborhood in the U.S., if they're in Cincinnati or something, all of these liberals who are cheering them on would be screaming for, you know, helicopters to go and destroy these people, because, you know, they are invading and setting up an ethno state. And the Syrian government is pluralistic. In Syria, you can be Sunni, you can be Shia, you can be Christian, you can be other ethnicities. And that is not what the anti-government rebels believe. They believe you have to be like them or you will have your throat slit. So somehow, though, in this formulation by Elba, it becomes that the Syrian government is the force for ethno-nationalism and fascism and so on. So what? What is the other side fighting for? Well, she's created this formulation, among others, that the Syrian government is fighting against cosmopolitanism. It's fighting against cosmopolitanism. Well, the supposedly cosmopolitan empire that's attacking Syria right now is using sectarians, religious sectarians, against Syria. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's what they're fighting. And is this the cosmopolitanism that they're fighting? I mean, they're just making stuff up and pulling stuff from the demonization of Russia and conflating Trump with whatever they don't like. And so that's the unfortunate situation that we're in now. You had said earlier that we exist in a period of profound political confusion. I thought we might elaborate on that. It seems to me, I'm just guessing at this point, but I mean, in terms of anti-war activity and so-called left activity, it seems that there's been a replacement of the narrative on colonial liberation, anti-colonial struggle that was there in the 60s and 70s, very inspiring, and lots of things happened. Material gains we're still trying to protect today. That's been replaced with this ideology of liberal human rights, where they'll scream about a country using force to defend itself as a justification to bring in the colonial power directly to, you know, remove governments.
Yeah, definitely. The big turning point, I think, in this turn towards the confusion that we are currently experiencing was, I think, the fall of the Soviet Union and the reduction of the socialist bloc. And the reason why I say this is because, you know, beginning in the late 1970s, the U.S. and the West began to experience an economic crisis of capitalism that created a desperate need to expand in all regions of the world where it had been unable to because of the presence of the Soviet Union as well as China. The socialist bloc had effectively blocked 30% or so of the planet from imperialist penetration, and that could no longer stand in a time where profits were sagging and new markets needed to be found. And so the Soviet Union fell, the U.S. was and its partners were able to extend into much of Eastern Europe as well as Africa and big parts of the Middle East and Asia and whatnot. And what this created was a need by the ruling class to, and the war makers, to concoct a new narrative that would justify these wars and ultimately make them palatable to people who had opposed these wars in the past. For the draft had ended after Vietnam, and now there needed to be a new narrative to justify expansion. And one of these narratives, along with the war on terror narrative, has been, as you say, the liberal human rights dogma that we hear a lot about, humanitarianism. And this, ultimately, it was built upon by the successive Democratic Party administrations from Carter to Clinton. But Obama really sowed the deepest, I feel, buttons into this narrative and entrenched it into all left political discourse by arguing to the international community, the United Nations, and to all countries of the world that the U.S. had a right to protect, that humanitarian intervention would be the model that the United States and its Western partners and its Gulf partners, et cetera, would pursue around the world, and nearly every war initiative that the U.S. undertook under its administration justified in that way, the most blatant example being Libya, where the Obama administration justified the destruction of an African country because of humanitarian grounds. And what that did was unleash this whole jihadist network that we see operating in Africa and making its way to Asia even, and across Europe and even into the United States. It unleashed something that is uncontrollable. But this narrative of humanitarian intervention infected the left deeply. It distorted consciousness. And because a black president, as well as you know, a president who was deemed as the hope for progressivism in the United States was saying it, it was okay. And this has not changed under the Trump administration precisely because the crisis has only become worse in the United States and the Western world. The economic situation is becoming almost untenable for most people. Inequality is at its highest, and the world is moving away from the United States in very tangible ways. The U.S. share of the global economy is shrinking, and so these wars become even more important as large sections of policymakers in Washington believe that a war with Russia, which Syria is a very big piece of, is a huge component to reestablishing U.S. military and economic hegemony in the world. So what we're seeing is this narrative infecting all forces in the United States, paralyzing them, disabling them from organizing around these questions. And, you know, it's shameful, really, that The Intercept would continue, because this isn't the first time that The Intercept has supported regime change and wars that the United States, the CIA, and all of their intelligence partners have been trying to indoctrinate into us. It's not the first time, but it certainly is a new way to spin it when we're talking about connecting an Arab nationalist state along with its allies who have done nothing but try to accommodate the imperialist powers. I mean, no one wants to talk about it. Elba certainly didn't talk about it when in 2012 the Syrian people voted on a referendum that only further opened up the state to opposition forces in order to maintain stability. And then she is also talking about the elections that the Syrian government had, multi-party elections that the Ba'ath Party and Bashar al-Assad won almost 90% of the vote. But because Syria is a white national state, it's a fascist state, the conclusion is that those elections are shams. Yet in the United States, every single election is basically a sham because it's controlled by the rich, and the rich decide. But now Washington has no idea what to do. Neither does the entire imperialist system really know what to do when that sham didn't work out in its favor this time. Now there's the Trump administration. There is Donald Trump, unpredictable, not the primary choice, basically somebody who most of the ruling class wishes didn't get as far as he did. Now he's there, and they have to deal with both the consequences and the benefits of that. And the consequences are pretty dire, given the fact that he's a huge blemish on the U.S. exceptionalist worldview around the world. And so the world is picking up even more steam in terms of moving away from the United States. And that's why we hear him talking about annihilating Korea and the DPRK, as well as ratcheting up with Iran, while the Senate and the House work on strangling him around war against Syria and Russia. It's a complete picture that we have to really see.
Yes. I mean, the neoliberal order, this order of corporate globalization, outsourcing, offshoring, and so on, it's getting harder and harder to sell, which is why if you run someone like Hillary Clinton against Trump, Trump can win, even mm-hmm. though they're both profoundly unpopular and deeply flawed and deeply disturbed individuals. And, you know, it brings us to the bigger problem that you addressed, which is, I mean, the United States, this U.S.-led order is really starting to decay in a relative sense, because there are countries that are emerging as economic powers or economic centers. You can talk about China and the links it's making with the rest of the world. You can talk about Russia recovering, India, other situations. And of course, the United States wishes to prevent the emergence of new trade routes, overland routes, energy routes, trade relationships, and so on. And I mean, that's a large part of what these wars are about and what this last 15 years of this war on terror have been about, which is to prevent, you know, the emergence of a new world. And they're really struggling desperately. And as you pointed out as well, a lot of countries have been fighting for their independence against the United States and its allies in Europe. And the problem is that they're running out of easy wars, because countries like Syria can fight back with the help of the Russians. Countries like North Korea can develop a nuclear weapons program. And that places us in a situation of even greater danger, at least here, because of these can escalate out of control. It's really a time when more than ever we need a critical left, a left that's very critical of the ruling class propaganda and what's being said. And instead of that, you get what The Intercept taking what the talking heads on TV are saying and magnifying it, saying, oh, yeah, the Syrians are just like that Trump government everyone doesn't like. Assad is Trump. Well, no, actually, Assad is not Trump. And you know why would you say that? And if you're going to say that, why do we read The Intercept? I can just open The New York Times or The Washington Post. I mean, there's a few stable or reliable publications, thanks to people like you. We have Black Agenda Report, and there's stuff like that out there, which have been good this whole time. And of course, Black Agenda Report predicted, you know, a lot of things about that election and, you know, just how deeply malfunctioning or dysfunctioning that system is and how there's so much misleadership or non-leadership in the organizations that are supposed to be resisting this. So, you know, I thank you very much for the work you're doing. You've been a very consistent writer for that publication. And, you know, you've been covering the Syria and the total lack of analysis, you know, by what calls itself the left, and there's this capitulation to demonization and orientalist concepts and so on. That, you know, that's very appreciated among the people that are watching this situation. So, I mean, we can, of course, tell people that they can read you and your upcoming articles in the future. The current one we're discussing, of course, is in relation to The Intercept. It's called The Intercept's Attack on the Oppressed is Why I Write. And that's from, I think, the 20th of this month. We'll put a link to it on our online distribution of this, but I know we'll hear more from you on that, and that we can expect pointed criticisms of lazy coverage and in fact, coverage that makes things worse, like that the article in The Intercept and similar kind of discussions. So I thank you again for bringing this all to our attention.
No problem. I appreciate you having me on.